trying to find out how many members we have on the system so that we can start maybe a minute or so earlier.
Good morning, Chair. Honorable Ismail.
Good morning, Honorable Ismail.
We only have two members, Chair, yourself and Ms. Ismail.
Thank you. We will then wait a short while.
Okay, thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Who do we have now? Ms. Majalamba?
We have Chair, Mr. Munyai, Ms. Wilson, Ms. Ismail, and Ms. Chero. We have five chairs. Let's wait for two more minutes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Good morning, members. We have Honorable Tukacho also. It's myself. It is, I'm going down the list, Wilson, Honorable Wilson, Honorable Ismail, Honorable Chilitsi, Honorable Tukacho, Honorable Chirwa. Yes, I think we will start this meeting of this morning. Good morning to everyone and very welcome to this meeting, to all the honorable members, to all the other guests who are present on our platform. To date, we have had a number of organizations having made oral presentations to the Portfolio Committee of Health on the NHI public submissions. And today we are going to have more oral presentations by three organizations, and then at the end of that we are going to have the adoption of minutes, four sets of minutes. We were planning to continue for this term and to try to continue all of our oral presentations, but the pronouncement on the local government elections on 1st of November of this year caused Parliament to rise today for members to attend to their duties in terms of the elections program. We will also therefore be continuing with the oral presentations from mid-November, as we have other obligations in terms of the parliamentary program. With that having said, Ms. Majalamba, can we just find out if we have any apologies and who are present in the meeting? Thank you.
Morning and thank you, Chair. Present is Dr. Jacobs, Mr. Munyai, Mr. Sokacha, Ms. Wilson, Ms. Ismail, Ms. Chero. Thank you, Chair. I've received apologies from Mr. Van Staden, Ms. Sukers, and Mr. Imam Sheikh. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I've also received a note from Ms. Wilson that should she have challenges with the connectivity, that we should accept that she might at times lose her connection. Now,
Sir President, before you continue, I'm on the road. I'm driving now. I'm leaving Kimberley. I'm leaving for the Eastern Cape. So I just hope my connectivity won't disappoint me on the road.
Thank you, Honorable Tukacha. Maybe you should be advised to stop somewhere when you have a good connectivity for a little while. Have some coffee and please participate with us. Thank you very much. Now, Honorable Members, I welcome you all again. Before we proceed, I'd like to remind you that this virtual meeting is deemed to be in the precinct of Parliament and therefore constitutes a meeting of a committee of the National Assembly for official purposes only. In addition to the rules of virtual sittings, the rules of the National Assembly, including the rules of debate, apply. Members enjoy the same powers and privileges that apply in a sitting of the National Assembly. Members should equally note that anything said in the platform, in the virtual platform, is deemed to have been said to the House and may be ruled upon. All members who have logged in shall be considered to be present and are are requested to mute their microphones and only unmute when recognized to speak. This is because the microphones are very sensitive and will pick up noise which might disturb the attention of other members. When recognized to speak, please unmute your microphone and connect your video. Members may make use of the icons on the bar at the bottom of the screen, which has an option that allows a member to put up his or her hand to raise points of order. The secretariat will assist in alerting the chairperson to members requesting to speak. When using the virtual system, members are urged to refrain or desist from unnecessary points of order or interjections. We shall now proceed with the order of the day and the business of the day. We have representations by three organizations, and those organizations are the Black Business Council, the Active Citizens Movement, and the Lawyers for Human Rights. We shall ask Ms. Majalamba to inform me who is present. The first representations will be done by the Black Business Council. If we can just know who is present to represent them. On their behalf. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Dr. Hopane is on the platform. I will hand over to him, to her. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Dr. Hopane, just to note that you have 45 minutes to do your presentation. I have seen that you have 64 slides. And they are quite full slides, so even if you have to do 2 minutes a slide, you are looking at over 2 hours already. So we give you 45 minutes, and then we will have 30 minutes for answers and questions and answers in the session. Thank you very much. Please proceed. I hope you've been made a co-host and that you're able to present your presentation. Thank you.
Okay, no, thank you, Dr. Jacobs, and greetings to the honorable members. I think there is a written input that was done by the BBC, so we will maybe skip certain slides as some of that had been done in the written presentation. Can I just ask, Chair, do I need to keep the camera on as I'm presenting and sharing my screen, or may I kindly switch it off?
I think it's good that we've seen you now. You can switch it off while you're presenting, but of course, when you answer any questions, you can switch it back on later. Thank you.
Please advise if you can see the screen.
Not yet.
Not yet, okay. Let me try again. I'm struggling to share. CEO Khanke, are you able to share your screen for me?
Dr. Gopane, while you're doing that, I hear you say CEO. Can you also introduce your team to us, please?
We've got the CEO of the Black Business Council, Mr. Khanke Matabane. I think I saw the deputy chair of the BBC portfolio, Mr. Gregory, entering. I think he's already logged on. And we've got the BBC administrator, Masedi, also logged on.
Thank you.
I'm really struggling, so I wanted to check if the CEO of Masedi can share on my behalf. unless the screen is now being seen.
No, it's not being seen. I hope they can they answer and say they can assist or not, so that we find another way to assist you.
Thank you, Chair. Let me try and share.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who can assist you?
I think it can be either the CEO or the administrator, Mercedes.
Are you going to use the same slide and just go through them faster, the slides which you forwarded to the portfolio committee?
Yes, we are.
Ms. Machilambo, you were able to fly those? That's going to be a
yes.
Bit of... Thank you.
Oh.
Okay.
Oh. Ms.
Machilambo has done that. Thank you. Please proceed, Dr. Khopane.
Okay. No greetings, committee members. I think you can proceed. The Black Business Council is an, I think you can, let's, because Ms. Majalamba, we have the along, let me skip the introduction of who we are as the Black Business Council. The Black Business Council would like to thank the portfolio committee. Would like to thank the Portfolio Committee on Health for this opportunity. The BBC, however, denotes the fact that 27 years in constitutional democracy, the healthcare sector has remained untransformed, and that our members who traverse the sector throughout the ecosystem continue to be constrained by the apartheid policies, which do not promote Black-owned business enterprises. It is our proposition that the SAPRA should prioritize dossiers submitted by the majority Black-owned and managed companies to be on the immediate fast track for the registration of medicines and supplementary products. Can go to the next slide. You can go to the next slide, Ms. Majalanku. The BBC notes the intention to introduce the NHI as a measured, progressive, and financially sustainable way, which is important for the improved access to healthcare for all patients. This needs to be achieved while ensuring the continuation of existing and viable healthcare businesses that help solve public healthcare challenges in both the short and long term, and contribute to much-needed economic growth and job creation in South Africa. The BBC looks forward to partnering with government to create sustainable business models that can appropriately support and assist efforts to ensure a secure, affordable, and accessible medicine supply as part of a viable, workable national health insurance system to be introduced. In order to be successful, it is essential that the universal health coverage system contemplated in the bill is backed by a sustainable healthcare sector. The businesses involved in the provision of medical and related goods and services. As such, many of the queries and recommendations raised in the submission seek to address the common goals of improved universal access to healthcare while allowing a robust and sustainable transformed supply chain. Legal clarity and certainty is of critical importance to allow businesses to plan and operate while complying with relevant laws. We respectfully submit that the BBC is unclear on the intentions of the bill in a number of areas. For example, the bill is silent on transformation and the promotion of triple BEE of locally manufactured medicines in line with the reindustrialization of our economy. We have thus raised a number of queries and in some cases offered suggestions. We therefore propose that for cohesion with other legislations which seek to redress the ills of the past created by the apartheid repressive laws, which sought to exclude black-owned businesses and ensure we forever do not participate in the mainstream pharmaceutical economy, which has remained untransformed. We have paid particular attention to the provisions of the bill that are relevant to the selection, procurement, supply, and pricing of medicine. South Africa has seen closure of in excess of 37 manufacturing primary and secondary packaging plants and facilities over the past 20 years, with a loss of in excess of 10,500 jobs. We therefore propose a deliberate plan which seeks to redress the latter if we are going to be able to re-industrialize the sector and create sustainable job opportunities while improving the security of supply of medicines.
Dr. Gopane, can I just quickly intervene? I see that the meeting is being transmitted live. Can you please switch on your camera, Radha? Thank you.
No, thank you.
And all other MPs too, please.
Thank you, Chair. From a business perspective, there is a need for recognition of the level of interdependence of the public and private sectors to deliver a sustainable and secure supply of affordable medicines, inclusive of innovative, generic, as well as core essential medicines list EML medicines. We further wish to propose that manufacturing of pharmaceuticals could be used to stimulate economic growth and create sustainable jobs locally by ensuring that the core EML are produced locally and through the bill, create a restricted list of products which cannot be imported into the country. Most of the developing economies have successfully developed the latter and in the process established security of supply of their EML. The success introduction and implementation of the UHC through NHI requires an unwavering security of supply of medicines, especially EML and chronic medication, which has eluded the public sector since the advent of democracy. South Africa currently imports in excess of 85% of their EML. Medicines are currently supplied to the state sector, most often based on differential pricing, which means that infrastructure, investment, and overhead costs are covered by revenue gained largely from the higher revenue private sector and allowing a portion of sales to the state sector at a discounted price based on volume. Total product supply cannot exist on pricing levels achieved in the state sector alone or at the lowest price as envisaged in the bill. An equitable cost-based pricing structure is recommended, which could be reference pricing, which will be in between the single exit price and the tender price as an example. We further propose that there must be a set aside of all state procurement of medicines, medicinal devices and equipment, distribution of medicines to healthcare sectors throughout the country, provision of services and all state, what the state procures for majority black-owned companies. Of fundamental importance to the bill and the sustainability of the NHI scheme and the healthcare sector is the mechanism that will be used to determine the prices for medication. As the bill stands, there appears to be a conflict between the contemplated mechanisms of pricing of medicines, the unforeseen knock-on effects of medicines pricing for those medicines not covered by the fund. No clear indication of how the setting of prices by the Office of Health Product Procurement will work in relation to the negotiation of prices by the fund and the single exit price, which will apply to the purchases by the fund. No clarity on whether a procurement process will be followed by the fund to procure medicines and scheduled substances as required by legislation applicable to the public sector. As such, our submission in relation to pricing predominantly pertains to these gaps, potential contradictions in the bill. For clarity, we have set out our submission regarding pricing under the following headings: negotiated single exit pricing, the procurement of medicines, health-related goods and health-related products, the reviewing of pricing, the role and powers of the Office of Health Products Procurement, and the relationship between the pricing committee and the other entities and committees, the pricing of Schedule Zero medicines, and the donation of medicines to the state. Medicines price in Section 2. The negotiated SEPs respectfully submit that the bill requires clarity on how the prices of medicines and scheduled substances will be determined for purchase by the fund. To this end, delineate a relationship between the SEP system created by the Medicines and Related Substances Act 101 of 1965 and the procurement of the medicines at the lowest possible price as contemplated in Section 11(2)(e) of the NHI Bill. In terms of Section 11(2)(e) of the Bill, the fund may enter into a contract for the procurement and supply of specific healthcare services, medicines, health-related goods, and health-related products with an accredited healthcare service provider, health establishment or supplier, and must inter alia negotiate the lowest possible price for goods and healthcare services without compromising the interests of users or violating the provisions of the Act. In the context of the Section 11(2)(e), we understand that it is intended that the fund negotiate lowest possible prices in respect of medicines, and that this power to negotiate is only subject to the interests of users and violating the provisions of the bill once enacted and other applicable law. We can go to the next slide. It is contemplated that Section 22 of the Medicines Act be amended to empower the Minister of Health in consultation with the Office of Health Products Procurement to appoint the members of the pricing committee, which are representative of all stakeholders, including BE and gender, to extend the application of the SEP to the sale of medicines and scheduled substances to the fund. As you'd appreciate, the current framework for determining the SEP is set out in terms of the Medicines Act and regulations relating to transparent pricing of medicines and scheduled substances, SEP regulations. Currently, it is contemplated that this framework, that the manufacturer sets an SEP in the absence of any formal benchmarking methodology, taking into account factors set out in the Regulation 5 of the SEP. The SEP, once set, shall not be increased for a period of a year and thereafter may be increased by the extent determined by the minister. Once the SEP has been set, this is the price at both which the fund and other persons can purchase medicines. There can be no negotiation on price. By virtue of wording of the Section 11(2)(e) of the bill and the fact that the power of the fund to negotiate the lowest price of the medicines is subject to applicable law, including the Medicines Act, the fund will not be able to negotiate lowest possible prices for medicines once the SEP is set. As such, we have read and understood Section 11(2)(e) as meaning that the fund will negotiate lowest possible prices with manufacturers for medicines prior to the SEP being set, which negotiated prices will then de facto become an SEP. Can skip to the next slide. In effect, the amendments of the Medicines Act will bind manufacturers of the medicines and scheduled substances to sell medicines to all purchasers at the prices negotiated by the fund, which will then become the decimal exit price, as a manufacturer may not sell medicines at any price other than the SEP if a lower price than the prevailing SEP is negotiated with any customer. The SEP has to be brought into line with all purchases. The implication of this is that, considering the intention of the bill for the fund to negotiate the lowest possible price, presumably on volume, such a price will de facto become an SEP and be applicable to all sales of medicines to all customers, even for one unit. You can skip to the next slide. Ms. Majalamba, I think you can skip to slide 24. Thank you. Thanks. Medicines pricing. Many of the requirements contemplated by the PFMA and the regulations and circulars, instructions, notices issued by National Treasury, as well as those of the triple PFA, are incompatible with the price setting mechanisms contemplated by Section 11(2)(e) of the Bill and the Medicines Act, and will, in context, if used, undermine the very purpose of Section 217 of the Constitution, which aims at, through the principles of fairness, equality, transparency, competition, and cost effectiveness, ensuring value for money. A system that promotes competition in the market, unlike an exclusionary tender-based system, promotes value for money in the long term. Should it be the case that it is intended that a tender process is set aside, as set out in the PFMA and the relevant procurement laws, be used to procure medicines, we fear that the market access for the broader healthcare sector, i.e. suppliers, will be limited. Current state tenders are exclusionary of other suppliers during the tender period, with only one or two suppliers being awarded all or the majority of the tender bodies. Based on the above mentioned principles, we set out a proposed model for medicine selection and pricing system for the NHI scheme in here too for your consideration. The BBC would like to appreciate the opportunity to expand on this proposal in the oral. You can skip to the next slide. In terms of Section 10(1)(g) of the Bill, the fund must determine payment rates annually for the healthcare service providers, suppliers, and health establishment in the prescribed manner and in accordance with the provisions of the Bill once enacted. Notwithstanding the inclusion of this provision in the Bill, it remains unclear as to whether this provision contemplates the annual increase in SEPs and how the SEPs will be increased. We request more clarity be set out in the Bill to issue the single asset prices, including when they will be increased and how frequently and on what basis. The role and powers of the Office of Health Product Procurement and the relationship between the Pricing Committee and other committees and entities. The Pricing Committee, established under the Medicines Act, will be appointed by the Minister in consultation with the Office of the Health Product Procurement. The Office of the Health Product Procurement is further responsible for the inter alia publishing of the single exit price at which medicines can be sold to the fund and other persons. We submit that the Bill is not clear on the nature of the relationship between the Office of Health Product Procurement and the Pricing Committee contemplated by the Medicines Act. In particular, it is not clear if the Office of Health Product Procurement will have a role in determining the SEP contemplated under the Medicines Act, and in particular, whether it will be responsible for negotiating the single exit price with suppliers. We refer to the Section 38(3) of the NHI Bill, which speaks to the functions of the Office of the Health Products Procurement. We request that the roles, functions, and powers of the Office of Health Products Procurement be clarified in the Bill. In addition, it remains unclear to what extent the Office of Health Products Procurement will be involved in the procurement of medicines. In terms of Section 38(2) of the Bill, it is provided that the Office of Health Products Procurement will be responsible for the centralized facilitation and coordination of functions related to public procurement in respect of, among other things, medicines. The powers conferred on the Office of the Health Products Procurement in terms of the section of the Bill are wide and ambiguous and should be more clearly defined. To the extent the Office of the Health Products Procurement will be responsible for procuring medicines, we recommend that a clear process needs to be included in the Bill, setting out and substantiating how the Office of the Health Products Procurement will determine which medicine must be procured for the NHI scheme. We point out that Section 22(g) will be amended to empower the Minister in consultation with the Office of Health Products Procurement to appoint for a period not exceeding 5 years such persons as he or she may be fit, members of the committee to be known as pricing committee. For the sake of transparency and independence, we recommend that the subjectivity inherent in Section 22(g)(1) i.e. the minister's discretion, to assess the fitness and properness of the appointee be maintained. We recommend that objective criteria for fitness and the propriety of a person to serve on the pricing committee and the skills and expertise or nature of the chemist should be expressly stated in the amendment to the Medicines Act, and a more detailed process for the appointment of persons on the pricing committee must be reflective of the landscape of South African society and inclusive of the appointees and be gender sensitive. Donations of medicines to the state. We respectfully point out that the current framework in respect of medicines, when read with the intended changes on Section 22G of the Medicines Act, as proposed in the schedule on the bill, prohibits health establishments and healthcare service providers from donating inter alia medicines to the state. We suggest that a carve out of the application in both Section 22G and 18B of the Medicines Act to the donations of medicines to the fund be included in the bill. We emphasize that in cases of natural disasters, epidemics, and other phenomena that have a wide-scale impact, it is important for the state to be able to readily access medicines, including through donations. As such, this kind of amendment is vital. In addition, it is important that the bill provide a clear process as to how donations can be made to the fund. Currently, the South African Health Products Regulatory Authority, SAHPRA, guideline for making donations to the state is difficult to implement in practice. To mitigate the risk of replicating the issue, we advocate that a clear process be defined with defined roles for relevant bodies be set out and included in the Medicines Act or the bill. It is our understanding of the bill that the fund or of the Office of Health Products Procurement will procure medicines. However, it is not clear how this procurement process relates to the formulary and the relationship between the fund, suppliers of medicines, and accredited health establishments or healthcare service provider that shall receive of the medications and how the process will work. In terms of Section 38.2, it is stated that an accredited healthcare provider and health establishment must procure according to the formulary, and suppliers listed in the formulary must deliver directly to the accredited and contracted healthcare service provider and the health establishment. The formulary is defined in Section 1 of the bill. You can go to the next slide. In terms of Section 11.2, the fund may contract for the procurement and supply of medicines, which must be aligned to the BBBEF and BBBPFA prescripts of subcontracting and empowering BE suppliers. Consequently, it is not immediately clear if suppliers of medicines will contract with the fund directly for the supply of medicines, or if they will, after the procurement process, be added to the list of suppliers in the formulary. Wherein the healthcare service providers and health establishments can procure medicines. We respectfully submit that greater clarity must be provided on how the formulary fits into the procurement and contracting process. Further, the following will need to be clarified. Will the health establishment and supply of medicines be required to enter into a separate agreement to the one concluded between the health establishment and healthcare service provider and the fund? When will the supplier be added to the formulary? Once every year or continuously? How will the payment be effected between the fund and the supplier of medicines, and when? Benefits covered by the fund. Section 25.5 of the bill, it is provided as follows. The Benefits Advisory Committee must determine and review the healthcare services benefits and types of services to be reimbursed at each level of care at primary healthcare facilities and at district, regional, and tertiary hospitals. Detailed and cost-effective treatment guidelines that take into account the emergence of new technologies, and in consultation with the minister and the board, the health service benefits provided by the fund. Access to essential medicines is fundamental to ensuring the provision of equitable health care to all users of the fund. equitable healthcare is currently achieved or promoted in the public sector through the use of standard treatment guidelines and the EML, and in the private sector through prescribed minimum benefits as provided by the Medical Schemes Act. PMBs comprise a list of minimum benefits with algorithms for chronic conditions and guidelines of some 270 to diagnosis and treatment pairs. A review of the PMBs under the auspices of the Council of Medical Aid Schemes is underway with the intention of moving to a service-based package from the current disease or condition-based package and incorporating primary health care and preventive medicine. The proposed benefit will serve as a minimum package that must be available in both the primary care and hospital setting. To ensure continuity of the healthcare services currently available to users and to ensure that there is no reduction in the extent of the healthcare services available to users after the implementation of the NHI scheme, this would be a retrogressive measure as explained in paragraph 7.110 below. The core versions of the PMB package and the SDGs and the EML to create a universal basic package is of vital importance. In other words, the NHI should not leave any South African worse off than they currently are in terms of access to care. To the extent that some or all South Africans are left worse off than they currently are, this could raise constitutional issues around the rights of these persons to access healthcare services. As we have indicated below, the Constitution guarantees that progressive measures will be taken by the state to realize the access to healthcare services. This guarantee is not consistent with the state introducing retrogressive measures, where existing levels of accessibility to medicines are not sustained post full implementation of the NHI scheme. There is a significant risk that the NHI scheme could be challenged for being a retrogressive measure. We therefore propose that the Benefits Advisory Committee should acknowledge the review process and embrace the conversions of the PMBs, SDGs and EML to form the basis of the benefits package for the NHI. Furthermore, we note that the bill is silent on the kinds of factors and considerations that the Benefits Advisory Committee should consider when determining the kinds of medicines that will fall into the NHI package. The absence of this kind of guidance in the bill could result in a benefit package that is arbitrary and out of touch with the needs of patients and the ability of suppliers to meet or satisfy supply demand. It is therefore essential that the bill specify the kinds of considerations that the Benefits Advisory Committee must take into account when identifying the kinds of healthcare services that will fall in the so-called benefits package covered by the fund. In terms of existing data, which shows the current availability of medicines in both the public and private sector, and which has set out graphically in paragraph 5.8 below, I think you can skip to the next slide and show the graphic. I think those are just the graphic illustrations of the number of molecules that are available in the private and public sector, which are significantly higher in the private sector. You can skip to the next slide. The conclusions set out in paragraph 5.7 raise a number of questions that will need to be addressed by the advisory committee when selecting and rationing medicines. Will the benefit package ration medicines available to EML medicines only? Will the benefit package allow for more EML medicines to be available? Will medicine availability accommodate the choice of current private sector patients? How will patients that require exceptional treatments and treatments for rare diseases be accommodated? E.g., if a patient cannot tolerate or suffers from EML medicine side effects, how will this patient's needs be catered for? Based on data availability of medicines in 2019, we suggest, as regards to medicine, that the following considerations should be given to the recommendations of the Benefits Advisory Committee when identifying medicines that should fall within the benefits package and how these medicines should be rationed. There must be continuity of healthcare services. To ensure that the NHI scheme is not retrogressive, there must be some level of assurance that the benefits package will not diminish the range of medicines molecules currently available to the user. The benefit package must allow for a wide choice of medications available to address the patient needs, especially in circumstances where EMR alternatives are needed. Evidence-based medicine must inform the selection of medicines for the inclusion in the benefits package. We further, as BBC, submit that the designated service provider, as provided for by the Medicines Act of 1998, should be, with immediate effect, be repealed or scrapped, as it disparages and promotes collusion amongst medical aid administrators, corporate retail pharmacy chains, to the exclusion of mainly community retail pharmacies, which in the main are majority Black-owned enterprises. Consideration of traditional and indigenous medicines, which are used by the majority of population in South Africa, will be considered in the bill. The concomitant regulatory process of the clinical trials will be explored utilizing local pharmacy schools based on our local universities and CSR innovation hub centers will be explored. We point out that the bill is silent on the right of healthcare providers such as doctors to prescribe medicines and schedule substances that are not provided for on the formulary to users. It is imperative that these health service providers retain the ability to prescribe medicines not provided for on the formulary, so as to not limit the ability of the user to access medicines and schedule substances or impact on the right of the prescriber to prescribe any registered medicine as appropriate. Invariably, in order to provide the basket of services, including medicines and scheduled substances, that is affordable and in the context of universal care in South Africa, the formulary will not be able to include all medicines that are currently available in the private sector, regardless of cost. I think you can skip the slide. Implementation of the bill. Section 57, transitional arrangements of the bill, contemplates that the implementation of the NHI is in two phases, namely phase one and phase two. Section 57 is silent on what will happen if positive outcomes linked to the stated phase one and phase two activities are not achieved before 2026, and whether further implementation of the bill will be suspended pending the achievement of these outcomes. By way of example, if the health strengthening initiatives contemplated in Section 57 have not resulted in most public health establishments obtaining certification by the Office of Health Standards Compliance by the end of Phase 2, then how will the NHI properly operate from 1 January 2026? Next slide. Consequently, there is a risk that the NHI will on paper be fully implemented prior to the positive and enabling outcomes of phase one and phase two activities being achieved. Given that the steps identified in phase one and phase two have been identified as necessary for the full operation of the NHI as contemplated in the bill, it is recommended that instead of rendering the operation of the NHI dependent on the lapse of the time period contemplated in phase two, it should be dependent on the actual achievement of the concrete milestones resulting from phase one and phase two activities, which will enable the proper rollout of the NHI. The document titled South African Government Strengthening the South African Health System Towards Integrated and Unified Health System, the Presidential Health Summit Compact, 25 July 2019, identifies nine pillars in relation to which the existing healthcare system needs to be improved or strengthened before we can move towards a unified healthcare system. You can pass the slide. And the next one. And the next, and this one. And this one, thanks. And this one. And the next one. Yes. Thanks. this excerpt from the pilot project report notes that the good monitoring system must be put in place to ensure the implementation of the phases under the bill are successful. These findings support our recommendation that the implementation of the bill requires a monitored and milestone and metric-based approach. There is a significant concentration of power under the bill in the Minister and the Chief Executive Officer of the Fund. We respectfully point out and submit that the effective governance of the Fund requires the imposition of checks and balances of these extensive powers. To this end, we make a submission of the following areas of the bill: the governance of the Fund, financial control, advisory committees contemplating Chapter 7 of the bill, the extensive powers of the ministers to make regulations in terms of Section 55 of the bill, the governance of the Fund. In terms of Section 13, the constitution and composition of the board of the bill, the minister will be vested with the powers to appoint the board members pursuant to nomination process for board member appointments. The minister must appoint an ad hoc advisory body to conduct public interviews of the shortlisted candidates and forward recommendations to the minister for approval. We point out that the bill is silent on who will be responsible for preparing the shortlisted candidates and on the criteria for the selecting members of the ad hoc advisory body. We recommend that, for the sake of independence and transparency, the criteria for the persons that may sit on the ad hoc committee be included in the bill, and that it be made express in the bill who retains the power to shortlist candidates. Clarity on these issues would be greatly welcomed. The responsibility of the CEO are set out in Section 20 of the bill and include at Section 24 of the bill, subject to the direction of the board. Responsibility for all income and expenditure of the fund or revenue received from National Treasury, all assets and liabilities of the fund, the proper and diligent implementation of the financial matters of the fund. It is recognized that Section 51 annual reports that the board is the accounting authority of the fund for purposes of the PFMA. As such, the ultimate responsibility for financial management of the fund should be in the hands of the board and not the CEO of the fund. Alternatively, the CEO, in carrying out his or her duties, should be subject to expressly stated fiduciary duties akin to those provided for in the Section 50 of the PMSA. Can skip. You can skip this one as well. And this one. Thanks, Sonia. The advisory committees. In the table below, we set out and consider the provisions of the bill concerning the board and the three advisory committees that will be established by the minister in consultation with the board, and the extent to which these provisions regulate the composition of the board, of these entities. Thanks. The advisory committees will be critical to the function of the fund, and as such, the bill contemplates their establishment as mandatory. Given their significance, we submit that the bill should set out a clearer framework for the establishment and composition of these committees, and at the minimum, the following issues should be addressed in respect to each committee in the bill: number of persons to comprise in the committee, procedure for appointing members, term of appointment, fitness of the person that may be appointed, compliance to the employment equity policies, procedure for removal of members of the committee, procedure to fill a vacancy on the committee, remuneration, and minimum number of annual meetings. Additionally, we point out that Section 30, vacation of office, applies to committees established in terms of this Act as opposed to those established in terms of Chapter 7. We submit that the Section 30 should be amended to apply to committees established in terms of this chapter. In addition, we note that as regards to the Healthcare Pricing Committee and the Stakeholder Advisory Committee. The bill is not clear in Section 26 and 27 respectively as to which person or body has the power to appoint the members of these committees. Sections 26 and 27 merely empower the minister in consultation with the board to establish these committees, but do not expressly confer a power thereon to appoint their members. It is requested that clarity be provided on these elements of Section 26 and 27. It is our recommendation that, for the sake of transparency and greater independence, the board be responsible for appointing members to the advisory committee, stakeholder advisory committee, and healthcare pricing committee, and not the minister. A transparent process for the appointment of these members must be set out in the bill. The excessive power of the minister to make regulations in terms of Section 55 of the bill. The BBC is concerned that the wide power conferred on the minister to regulate the affairs of the fund and relationships of stakeholders to the fund and to each other in terms of Section 55 without legislative oversight is a lawful delegation of powers by the legislation. In Affordable Medicines Trust and Others versus Minister of Health in RSA and another Affordable Medicines, the court made the following statement about delegation of powers by the legislature. The delegation must not be so broad or vague that the authority to whom the power is delegated is unable to determine the nature and scope of the powers conferred, for this may well lead to arbitrary exercise of delegated powers. Where broad discretionary powers are conferred, there must be some constraints on the exercise of such powers so that those who are affected by the exercise of the broad discretionary powers will know what is relevant to exercise of those powers or in what circumstances they are entitled to seek relief from the adverse decision. These constraints will generally appear from the provisions of the empowering statute as well as the policies and objectives of the empowering statute. It is our respectful submission that because of the enormous potential impact of the NHI on both individual rights and the establishment of public and private healthcare sectors, not to mention the impact of the NHI on the fiscus, and therefore on the general public, the nature and parameters of the legal relationship between the various institutions referred to in the subsections to Section 55 quoted above should be determined by the legislature. The minister may be suited to regulating the final details of such relationship, but Parliament itself should determine these issues. I think you can pause this. In terms of Section 56(1) of the bill, the fund may issue directives which must be complied with in the implementation and the administration of the Act. This provision is widely stated, and as such, it is not clear where the ambit of the fund's authority to issue directives is limited to the areas specifically referred to under the following section of the bill, Section 10(1)(f) of the bill, which empowers the fund to issue directives for the regular, appropriate, and timeous payment of healthcare service providers, health establishments, and suppliers. Section 39(11) of the bill, which empowers the fund to issue directives relating to the listing and publication of accredited healthcare service providers and health establishments. For this reason specified in relation to Section 55, a wide delegation of Parliament of Regulatory Authority, which is not constrained by empowering statute, would be vulnerable to legal challenges on the basis of unconstitutionality. Therefore, Section 56(1) should be clarified to the effect that it is only in relation to the areas described above that the fund has the power to make directives. It should also be clarified exactly who and which institutions would be bound by such directives and what mechanisms will be available to the fund or any other person for the purposes of enforcing compliance therewith. Chair, I'm not sure how much time I still have left.
I thought I would leave you at Kopane until 10 o'clock, since you were struggling a bit in 5 minutes.
Okay, no, thank you. In addition to the above, it is not clear from the provision of Section 56 of the Bill if the provisions of the Section 56 are intended to ensure that the Fund can self-regulate its performance and compliance with both legislative and contractual obligations and all those applicable to any of those organs, agents such as the advisory committees, the CEO, the Office of Health Products Procurement, which, according to the Section 38(2) of the Bill, must be located in the Fund. To the extent that this is the intention, we would recommend against the Fund having self-regulatory powers and instead these powers be centralized in an oversight body. Next slide. We can move to the next slide. We point out neither the Bill nor the Medicines Act accommodates a dispute resolution mechanism for complaints about the pricing of medicines and scheduled substances and decisions relating to annual price increases in medicines and how decisions relating thereto can be appealed. Although Chapter 9 of the Bill sets out complaints and appeals process, it is not wide enough to accommodate complaints about pricing of medicines and scheduled substances, nor does it permit for manufacturers to make complaints about prices that have been set for medicines and scheduled substances. Given the significance of these kinds of decisions, it is important that a clear and efficient mechanism for dealing with these kinds of decisions be demarcated either in the Bill or the Medicines Act. Given that the Medicines Act currently regulates SEPs and contains a clear appeal mechanism in the Section 24A, we recommend that these kinds of complaints be dealt with in terms of Section 24A of the Medicines Act, and that this provision of Medicines Act be amended to accommodate appeals of these kinds of decisions, as well as complaints from manufacturers on prices that have been set for medicines and scheduled substances. I think, Chair, the rest are more on the definition issues that we had raised in the Bill. It is in our written submission. I think I would like to pause there and thank the committee for this opportunity, and to say that the BBC broadly supports the NHI and wishes that some of the matters that we have raised will be taken into consideration with any other amendments. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Kopane. Anybody from your team wants to say anything in 2 minutes?
Okay, I'll allow the CEO of BBC, if he would like to say something. I think he's the one sharing the screen, Mr. Khanki Matabane.
Honorable Chairperson, honorable members, we also would like to apologize for last week. We had connectivity issues, and hence we were only presenting today. In our midst, we also have the Vice President of the BBC, Vice President Professionals, Yvonne Maitin, and then we also have Grigori Mufuke. Our submission here is that we're sitting 27 years into democracy, and there has not been much movement in terms of economic transformation. The majority who have been excluded are still sitting almost owning less than 5% of the economy. The ownership and the management of the country has not necessarily changed in all sectors held into that. So we would like the bill to try and assist us and assist the country in moving into a more just and transformed economy. Thank you very much. Those are just my general submissions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Matabane. Of course, we want to thank Black Business Council. We want to thank Dr. Matabane for the presentation. And, of course, also the rest of your team. Honorable members, just allow me to welcome the Deputy Minister. He joined us very early in the meeting. I had just not recognized him, and also members of his team. I also want to welcome Honorable Sangwa, who has joined us. We also have an apology of Honorable Hansdaden. And then there are two members who are having difficulties with their connections, Honorable Dr. Jim McQuarrie and Honorable Wilson. There are members who want to raise questions. I'm going to name those members in the following order. So they will be asking their questions, and they will go directly from one member to the other. Honorable Munyai, Honorable Gela, Honorable Ismail, Honorable Abbott. And are there any other members who want to, I see Honorable Siwela. I hope that's a question, Honorable Siwela, and any other members who want to ask any questions.
Excuse me, Chairperson, is Dr. Tembekwayo. I just want to tell you that I've locked in.
Thank you. Are you going to ask any questions, Honorable Tembekwayo?
Not for this presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honorable Siwela? Honorable Siwela, I see your hand is up.
Yes, Chairperson. Can I proceed?
No, that's for you to ask a question. You indicate you want to ask a question?
Yes, I do.
Thank you. So you would be last in the line here, Honorable Siwela. It's Honorable Munyai, Gela, Ismail, Abbott, and then yourself, and then I will also raise some questions. Thank you very much. Please proceed in that manner, Honorable Members. And please do not forget to switch on your cameras as it is possible for you to do.
Honorable Chair and esteemed Honorable Members, I have a video problems because where I am, there's a very bad network. The broadband is not really up to scratch, so please allow me not to do that. The first question that I want to ask Dr. Hopan is that the presenter, she was speaking about continuity of the healthcare system, the current status quo, which we know, Honorable Chairperson, it's a two-tier system that really benefits the rich few and the poor are excluded. So is that what you want to see happening, the two-tier system to continue in the continuation of the healthcare system in that context, if she can clarify? The other question that I want to put forward, the concern of Dr. Khopane, I think, was about the lack of clarity. This is the second issue. In setting up prices of the offices of the health product procurement is noted. But if I can direct them to Section 26 of the bill, which talks about the healthcare benefits pricing committee, as one of the advisory committee of the fund, consisting of 16 to 24 members. Among the committee members, your industry will be also represented, so that all issues that can be raised and discussed during the pricing settings. It should be important that I ask the following question. Do you need more clarity in this regard? If so, please, because if you look at Section 26, it clarifies the issue that you have raised. One of the key issues that I want to ask you, with regard to annexity, for example, the bill is silent on the transformation and the promotion of the triple BEE. Did you miss Section 38? Because it's important that the presenters, when they come here, they must be comprehensive. They should have read the bill in entirety. That's the expectation. If you look at did you miss Section 38? Subsection 7 of the bill, which states that provision of the section will be subject to the public procurement laws of the country, and as well as the policies of the Republic of South Africa. That gives effect to the provision of Section 217 of the Constitution. including the Preferential Procurement Policy Framework Act of 2000 and Act Number 5 of 2000, and the Broad-Based Black Economic Empowerment Act of 2003. This is there. I mean, why then the question that arises seeks to say that the bill is silent on the broad-based black economic empowerment. It is our advice that at least when the members want to come and present, they should have read the bill in entirety. But also, Honorable Chair, allow me to ask the last two questions to the presenter, which is very, can the BBC provide clarity on the understanding of the content of the Regulation 19 of the, of the Medicines Pricing Regulation? It is my understanding that there is where international benchmarking is applied when setting of the SEEP. Given the presentation, that does not seem to acknowledge that the reference of pricing is incorporated in the determination of the SEEP. May I please get clarity what BBC proposes as the replacement of the existing benchmarking exercise during the setting of the SEPS? That is very much important. And I think it is also important to raise the following last question, Honorable Chair, that it seems that the interest of the BBC is also about access to financial to procurement of the medicines, which suppose I think some of their members are business people in big pharma and so on. So I think we should be much more be interested in the people, the quality of care of our people, than the big profit. That would be my argument. But I would want them to clarify on those specific details of the question that I've raised, Honorable Chair and Honorable esteemed members. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me also welcome the presentation from the BBC. I'm having a few questions that I want to ask, but before, maybe one must welcome the presentation. Also, I'm glad in your last part, Dr. Tsego, when you are saying you support the NHI bill. I think this is a good move for us as South Africans to have NHI to be implemented in our country. Coming to the questions that I want to ask, you have pointed out that the drafters of the bill do not appear to have taken account of the constitutional implication of the NHI scheme with regards to in respect to procurement of medicine. Can I also point you to Section 38(7) of the bill, which states that provisions of this section will be subject to public procurement law and policies of the Republic that give effect to the provision of Section 217 of the Constitution, including the Preferential Procurement Policy Framework Act 2000. Please clarify what you suspect has been left out in this regard, as you indicated in your presentation. The other question that I want to ask, your recommendations that preferential procurement principle are laid out in the PPPFA number 5 of the 2000 be implemented when state procures medicines do you perhaps this principle need to be specified within the bill, or they can be included in the regulations? My other question, does BBC prefer a price control mechanism per molecule type, irrespective if it's a generic or originator product for medicine pricing, or a negotiated lowest price per product being sold by manufacturers? Just as a reminder, price control is currently not in force in South Africa, but manufacturers set their own price per SEP and for the tender process. The other question, BBC is requesting that a lot of additional information should be included in the Act, including process issues. Is it BBC views that the bill as an enabling legislation should contain all of these, or would you support that most of these issues can be contained in regulation? Can you please provide clarity? The other question, I think that will be my last question that I'm going to ask. Is the presenter aware of the fact that ministers draft regulations that then they go through a public participation process? Parliament is not the normal arm of governance or a state that draft the regulations. Lastly, Chairperson, is BBC comfortable with a progressive introduction of NHI in line with Section 27 of the Constitution? Can you provide a clarity on what you termed NHI leaving a certain sectors worse off than they currently are in terms of healthcare coverage? What do you mean by this in the current majority of the population are left worse off, and NHI is meant to readdress this? I think this one would be lastly, Chairperson, will bear with me. BBC appears to be of the view that a certain provision in legislation, for example, Medicines and Related Substances Act, are designed to exclude certain stakeholders from operating in the pharmaceutical supply chain. With respect to the bill, can BBC identify those sections in the bill that refer to this? Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Good morning, and thank you for the presentation. I just have four questions. My first question: in what ways do you view the NHI benefiting and supporting Black, that is public and private, healthcare professionals? My second question, in slide 7, you mentioned there's a need for interdependence between public and private. Please clarify what you mean by interdependence. Would you prefer a parallel system? If so, why? What are the flaws of the current proposed structures of the NHI? My third question, what methods should be put in place to prevent corruption and irregularities in procurement processes? Now, with COVID, we have seen massive corruption with PPE procurement. What proposals or solutions can you offer to balance prioritization of Black-owned companies, but also prevent and mitigate opportunities for such a policy to take advantage of the system? And my last question, you seek to promote and address the injustices of the past by advocating for transformation and the promotion of BEE within the Act. At the same time, you highlight the need to ensure tender processes must follow the principles of fairness, competition, cost-effectiveness, and ensuring value for money. Now, as much as this is a noble cause, we all know how government abuses BEE policies to give tenders to the politically connected Black elite. They exclude price and competition, resulting in poor tender deliveries. Now, what solutions do you propose that can ensure good transformative policies in the procurement processes within the NHI that will benefit small Black-owned businesses? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I welcome the presentation from BBC. I have two questions. Number one, BBC appears to be of the view that a negotiated price under NHI cannot be regarded as a single exist price SEP. Can I get some clarity as to what informs this view? Second one, the BBC has presented interpretations of this bill that need further exploration. Can the presenter clarify where in the bill does he get the notion and the interpretation that implies that users will be made worse off when NHI is implemented? Is this your own interpretation? Can the presenter also highlight sections in the bill that imply that NHI will introduce retrogressive health offering to its population? Thank you.
Honorable Siwela.
Yes, Chairperson, and thank you very much. Let me also welcome the presentation. I have two questions to ask. I've got two questions to ask. The first one, Chair, with regards to the pricing of the originator and the generic medicine, can I get clarity what BBC is proposing, which is not already happening in South Africa? I heard that something worth considering in this regard that you said is already happening in Thailand. Can BBC please clarify what this pricing system might be and its utility to the South African context? Lastly, Chair, just to clarify, the current SEP pricing regime accommodates unit pricing, which applies to the pricing of units. In the presentation, BBC seems to believe that the bill will allow manufacturers to sell units at SEP. Did I hear this correctly? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, honorable members. I only have two questions I want to raise, very short questions. The one speaks to the BBEE points which you raised, and the other one about the challenge to the legislative framework. So the question is whether it's appropriate for BBC to challenge the legislative framework that embraces transformation to redress the injustices of the past, as reflected very clearly in the preamble to the bill. Now, we heard what Mr. Matabane was saying, and we heard him speaking about the redresses of the past, and so in the context of that, I want to ask him the question. And is the BBEE that you have referred to not implied in the preamble and also in Section 38, Subsection 7 of the Office of Health Products Procurement in the Bill? Now, we've heard a lot of questions raised on the single exit price, and it was raised quite strongly in your presentation. So my understanding is that currently the SEP is applicable to a limited private sector population. Is it not correct that as a result, and if it is applied nationally, that economies of scale are expected to take effect on the final price of any pharmaceutical? Now, also in your presentation, BBC appears to have reservations with this approach as proposed in the bill. Can you please give us some clarity on that reservation? And what exactly are you proposing to achieve the desired economies of scale? I think those are all the questions which are raised by the honourable members. I'm going to hand back to Dr. Kupane and Mr. Matabane and the team to answer any questions. We must be very mindful that we have asked many questions, honourable members. We have taken 21 minutes of the time of the 30 minutes where we are doing questions and answer session. But yes, let's just be mindful as we do the future presentations of the questions which we raised. Dr. Kupane and Mr. Matabane, you're very welcome to answer the questions. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Chair. I think the majority in large are related to pricing and procurement, which I will hand over to Mr. Matabane and Mr. Mofokeng. I think the only, I'll answer to only two raised by Honorable Munyai on do we suggest the continuation of the current two-tier system. No, Mr. Munyai, I think the BBC by and large supports the NHI, and under no circumstances do we think that this is a sustainable system. We are in support of equitable access to healthcare and social justice. So we are definitely not supporting a two-tier system. If it was implied in the presentation, it is certainly a misinterpretation. I think there was another question, I think, on where the users of the bill, I think it was raised by two speakers, where the users would be left worse off. I think it was a caution on the BBC's part to say that there is access to healthcare currently both in the public and the private healthcare sector of a certain minimum, and we would not want the NHI to leave the users of healthcare worse off than they currently are, as this might pose constitutional challenges if in fact the benefits packages end up lower than what currently users of healthcare are used to or have access to in the current form. So I think for me, those are the two questions. I think by and large, the bulk of it was around pricing and procurement. And I will pause there and allow Mr. Matabane to take the rest. Thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. We'll ask Mr. Mofokeng, who's the Vice President Business, to start with the questions, and then I'll answer the rest after that.
Thank you very much, Chair, and good morning to the honourable members. Chair, I will address the issue of triple B and triple PFA broadly, as they were asked by various honourable members. Chair, we welcome the fact that there is obviously a link between the bill and the triple BEE, and of course the section 217 of the Constitution in terms of the procurement processes that will ensue. However, Chair, what we want to emphasize is that, right at the top, we see an opportunity here to re-industrialize our economy. In that re-industrialization, we do then expect to work hand in glove with government to ensure that we build once again a viable pharmaceutical sector in the country. That will then mean that we need to be specific in terms of which products are we saying will be manufactured locally to ensure security of supplies of medicines, number one. But number two, Chair, we do know that if we just approach it from a crude business perspective and we do not become nuanced in terms of ensuring that there is meaningful Black participation in that process, we are going to miss the boat. Hence, you know, in our presentation, we are specific around issues of set asides to ensure that, you know, Black manufacturers who are already there and those who are intending to enter the sector can be supported through a legislation such as this bill. Now, from where we are sitting, Chair, you know, there is a couple of things that we think that can be achieved by doing this. And the unfortunate reality is that we do not have a sector charter council that deals with the health and pharmaceutical sector at this stage. You will realize, Chair, that across some of the sectors such as construction, property and so on, we've got specific sector charter councils that deal with targets that must be reached in terms of transformation. And we are hoping that through this process, you know, we can then be able to lay a foundation, you know, for this sector to have those targets in order to ensure that Black participation is meaningful and is secured. On the the issue of the BBB itself, Chair, we welcome, of course, like I said, the link that the bill makes with BBBE. And also we have to be mindful of the fact that even under that broad legislation, government has introduced programs such as the Black Industrialists Program, which needs to be supported. And there are three aspects under the Black Industrialists Program that are quite key. One is access to market, which this bill should then lay a foundation for. Two is access to finance. And three, generic support to those companies that will be benefiting under the Black Industrialists Program and be able to be assisted to be manufacturers. So when we look at this bill, Chair, we look at this bill as an opportunity to then lay a foundation for those Black industrialists in the pharmaceutical sector, for instance, to be supported, to be able to play a meaningful role, you know, in the supply of medicines into the NHI. So Chair, that's the angle we are coming from. And I think the issue of the triple PFA as well, we have we acknowledge that there is a triple PFA, and we also are mindful of the fact that the public procurement bill is being processed as we speak, and we have made inputs there, extensive inputs, to the extent that we have made a submission around issues of again, you know, making sure that there are set asides that will be, put there for, you know, the targeted groupings such as Black companies, women-owned, youth, and so on and so forth. So, Chair, we are very mindful of that, and we just wanted to present a case here to say that the bill should, be structured such that it lays a very strong foundation for the rollout of those programs that we see as critical to enable participation of Black entities in the pharmaceutical space as well. Finally, Honorable Hasina Ismail asked a question around how do we prioritize Black companies and how do we have a transparent process in this? And let me, in answering this, just say that there is a very well documented process of how we put panels together in doing business with government. Is a very transparent process wherein we are able to see who are the companies that are tendering that are going to be included in these panels, the pricing that they will then be utilizing in the procurement process. So the process is very much transparent. If one looks at National Treasury, there is provision for transversal contracts in there. It's a very transparent process. Everybody knows who are the players and the pricing structure so that there is transparency. And I think a similar process can be followed here to ensure that there's transparency on all fronts. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much to all of you from the Black Business Council. Is there anyone else who wants to raise anything? You have 30 seconds.
Yeah, Chairperson, we would like to make a request. Also, it will help the committee in terms of the time. We'd like to propose that on the issues of the SEPs, can we the BBCB provided an opportunity to submit a written response? I think that is just what I wanted to ask you, Chairperson, and the committee to consider.
Thank you very much. We appreciate you coming to do the presentation today. We note it, and yes, we look forward to you giving us a written response on the SEPs and any other matters which you think you maybe have not answered. And I think I'm just going to give Dr. Popane 30 seconds, final comments, thank you, and then we will move on to the next group.
No, thank you. I have no additional comments except to say that we are thankful for the opportunity and we do support a universal health coverage through the NHI SPBC. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You're welcome to stay on and listen to the other presentations, or you're also welcome to leave. Ms. Majalamba, can you give us an indication of the next group, whether they are here, and also introduce them for us? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. The next group, which is Active Citizens Movement, is on the platform. I will hand over to Dr. Bongosi Shosi. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. Can you hear me?
We can hear you very well. Thank you very much. You have 45 minutes to do your presentation, which you probably heard earlier, and we will then have a question and answer session of about 30 minutes. Thank you very much for coming to present to us today, Active Citizens Movement. We're looking forward to hearing your presentation. Thank you.
And thank you very much for having me. Thank you for the introduction, Chairperson. My name is Bongosi Shosi, and I'm here to give you all a overview of the written submissions made by the Active Citizens Movement on the National Health Insurance Bill that was published in 2019. So to just give you an indication of the way I want to approach my presentation this morning. Firstly, given that the members have had an opportunity to view the written submission ahead of time, I don't want to go in a detailed point-by-point analysis, but rather to just give an overview of our recommendations, as well as in the second part of my presentation, address specific points that we as the Active Citizens Movement think are important and that I want to really emphasize and drive home. So we have structured our written submissions around certain key areas of concern, but in this presentation this morning, I just want to give you a bird's eye view of those key areas of concern as well as other aspects of our presentations. So this slide really just shows, excuse me, an overview of my presentation this morning in terms of giving you an overall indication of the content of our submission. So first and foremost, I think it's important for us to emphasize that we are unequivocally in support of universal health coverage. We think that it's an important cause that unfortunately has been delayed by various factors. Indeed, if one looks at the reports by the Universal Health Coverage Global Monitoring Group, UHC has really gone through a slow process of development globally. And therefore, we think that this initiative to bring universal health coverage to South Africa is an important one. And we are, again, very much in support of it, specifically because of the various lacks in the health system in South Africa. As many of you probably already know, only 70% of South Africans have medical insurance and the rest rely on the public health system, which is problematic because in the private health system, we face extremely high and exorbitant costs. And in the public health systems, because of various infelicities within that system and the continued deterioration of state infrastructure, many people who need healthcare can't access it. And so we've made various submissions that we think can help the NHI Bill create a strong and independent National Health Insurance Bill, which is important in the broader context of what we describe as a crisis of governance that we've seen in South Africa in recent years, with shortcomings in things like service delivery and various state-owned enterprises collapsing. We think that it is in the best interest of South Africans that the National Health Insurance create institutions that are functionally independent and are therefore strong enough to deliver on the various promises of the bill. The statement of belief is something that we included at the beginning of our written presentations to essentially communicate the basis upon which we both support the National Health Insurance Bill as well as the basis upon which many of our recommendations are based. I won't go into it in any level of detail, but broadly we are in support of principles of equity, cross subsidization and social solidarity. And those inform our support of the NHI bill. But we also think that it's important that any sort of movement in the universal healthcare space in South Africa be guided by the principles of transparency and accountability and address certain structural barriers and social impediments, as well as remedying the current issues within the public health system. So, first and foremost, I want to address the group of recommendations that touch on various constitutional implications of the bill. These are issues that we think are very important to address, because if they aren't addressed and the bill moves forward and becomes an act of parliament, we fear that its effectiveness will be bogged down by unnecessary litigation over things that can be corrected at this point before we get to the point where individuals are bringing claims which stall the progress of universal health coverage. First and foremost, the scope of individuals who are permitted to be users is delineated in a way that we think is problematic, primarily because the rights upon which universal health coverage is prefaced in South Africa, specifically Section 27, are not limited only to individuals who are what might be described in the bill as documented citizens or documented foreigners, and therefore we think that the use of language such as illegal foreigners as excluded from the definition of users raises certain problems, and we think that the definition of users within the bill should be guided by a principle of non-discrimination, again for the reasons that I alluded to earlier, basically to avoid individuals who are excluded bringing constitutional challenges to the bill. This is especially important within the broader context of the lived reality of South Africa. We know that the Department of Home Affairs has certain systemic issues that cause delays in individuals like asylum seekers getting the required documentation, and even citizens having required documentation. And therefore, the focusing of the user definition on the provision of documentation might cause many people who are by rights deserving of access to the services of National Health Insurance being excluded as a result of, for example, the incapacity of the Department of Home Affairs to deal with the large number of individuals that it has to service. Another issue that we think needs to be addressed relates to Schedule 4 of the Constitution, as well as the other schedules relating to the various levels of government and the competencies to deal with certain areas, specifically health services, which is a area of governance that is concurrent between the state and the province. Various aspects of the bill, which operates at a national level, relates to certain aspects that are arguably within the competence of other levels of government. This potentially causes conflicts with the other levels, and we think that it's necessary for this to be more clearly addressed. We go into more detail about how this might be done in our recommendations, but I just wanted to touch on that briefly. Another issue, which I'm going to go into more detail later, has to do with the accountability in terms of the fund. The fund is, as is currently provided for in the bill, accountable directly to the minister as opposed to parliament. This is problematic because in terms of the PFMA, an entity is responsible for the submission of its annual reports, including financial reports, to parliament, which is currently, again, not provided for within the bill. And we think that it's important that this be clearly stated and addressed in order to avoid a situation where the function of the NHI fund is technically in contravention of the requirements of the PFMA. Another constitutional issue has to do with Section 28, the best interest of the child. As the bill is currently structured, there's something of a gap, namely that individuals who are children of users automatically become users, and people who are not children of users must then go through alternative processes to become users. There is provision made for individuals who are in child-headed households, but that kicks in after the age of 12. And so for individuals who are, one, in not in child-headed households, and two, who are under the age of 12, it creates a situation where they don't have a mechanism for being able to become users of the national health insurance. We're thinking specifically with this individuals who are the children of persons who, for whatever reason, unreasonably prevent their children from accessing national health insurance. We think that because of these children's rights in terms of Section 28, provision needs to be made for circumstances such as this. Now I want to touch on, as I mentioned before, some important governance issues, because this is really our main concern with the bill as it stands. One of the biggest issues, which has been touched on in earlier presentations, and I'm sure by other submissions of other days, the fact that the fund is intended to function as an autonomous Schedule III A public entity, but various key individuals within the structure of the NHI fund are accountable to and appointed by the minister. This is frankly bad governance, and we think that it's important that this structure be addressed in a way that gives it more independence in a similar fashion to other state institutions such as the South African Health Products Regulatory Authority and Legal Aid. We also think that as an aspect of that, it's important there be more transparency in how these appointments are made, and that is something that we touch on in the next recommendation. The PFMA gives the government power to hire and fire against certain core individuals within the functions of an entity. And we think that this is something that could potentially hamstring the fund's independence. And so we argue that the bill should provide for giving the minister, or not giving the minister unfettered control over appointments, but rather the removal of these voting provisions. And a panel should be established through a public participation process where candidates are interviewed for the board, and they should be credible, independent, and respected individuals from all sectors of society. And that panel can then make recommendations to the minister, who may then accept or reject them, but the reasons for those must be in writing. They must be publicly accessible so that they can be reviewed and potentially sent back for reconsideration. Another issue touches on the fact that the requirements for the CEO to meet with certain institutions within the fund, we think, go to the level of being onerous, such as, you know, requiring that the CEO meet with the Minister of Health four times per annum to exchange information. And it creates an environment that it's apparent that the CEO is essentially directly accountable to them. And therefore, we think that this, again, needs to be more clearly addressed, that the CEO is appointed by and accounts to the board, and that any communication between the CEO and the minister goes through the board. Another issue is that ministerial advisory committees are appointed by and report to the minister, which again raises serious questions about their capacity to function in an independent way. And therefore, we argue for a structure of these committees where they are give the board a co-equal role in appointing and monitoring the function of the ministerial advisory committees. Moving on to issues away from governance, an issue that we think is potentially something that could cause quite a bit of a legal controversy has to do with the relationship between the National Health Act and the National Health Insurance Act once it comes into effect. The structure of the act and its wording implies that the NHI will only be subservient to the Constitution and the PFMA. However, the National Health Insurance Act is currently the overarching health legislation, and certain functions that are conceivably going to be performed in terms of the NHI overlap with things that are currently being done by the National Health Council. And so we think that this just needs to be looked at in more detail in order to avoid overlap and potentially the duplication of labor. Something that, again, I'm going to touch on in more detail has to do with the role of medical schemes. Briefly here, there's been a number of questions about how medical schemes will be impacted by the National Health Insurance system. And we think that it would assist in allaying the concerns of many South Africans. So this was something that was addressed more clearly within the bill itself, including how the current role of medical schemes will be phased out. Another issue in a similar way that we think needs to be explicitly addressed to allay the fears of many South Africans has to be questions around the financing of the bill. And this has to do with the cost of the administration, as well as how mechanisms will be built in to avoid fraud and corruption. And we make a number of recommendations in this regard, such as how annual tariff increases need to be reviewed by the Treasury, with the final approval being made by the minister. These are various aspects that we recommend, primarily with the goal of making it clear to the general public and people who are perhaps skeptical about the bill and about misappropriation of funds. Creating a system that fosters confidence and that's transparent, we think, would be in the best interest of South Africans and would inspire more confidence, I think, amongst individuals who are perhaps dubious about whether the National Health Insurance system is something that can work in the South African context. We also think that there needs to be, in the immediate short term, enabling legislation to achieve savings from the private sector expenditure through negotiating revised fee structures to make medical aid more affordable in the run-up to the full implementation of the NHI, sort of creating transitional arrangements between the initial phases as well as the later phases when the NHI is in full effect. There's a number of other briefer issues that we touch on, such as terminology and definitions, as well as amendments regarding to certain functions, but I don't want to touch on those. I'll just conclude this first part of my presentation by saying that we believe that the measures in the National Health Insurance Bill are critical to the achievement of the universal health coverage agenda in the South African context, and that this is something that we think is too important to allow to fail. And so a consultative process will result in good law, and more transparency will allow the NHI and any structures it creates to survive constitutional scrutiny. And there's a brief quote there that was included by the my co-drafter for our comments that I think expresses the significance of the NHI bill and the broader agenda of promoting universal health coverage. Now, I just am going to stop sharing my screen because the points I'm going to talk on are addressed in specific slides, but in more detail within the submissions that we've made. So I'm just going to direct the members to specific pages and briefly and concisely state the contents of our recommendations within the context of those particular recommendations. So firstly, I want to address the issue of governance, independence, and accountability, which we speak to on pages 5 to 6 of our written submissions. You can also see our recommendations in slides 7 to 9 of the presentation that I just went through. This issue is perhaps one of the greatest areas of concern for South African systems, given the various controversies in recent years regarding the governance of state entities. And we think good governance requires both independence and accountability. What the bill currently says is that the fund is established as an autonomous public entity in terms of the PFMA. However, the fund's board is effectively accountable directly to the minister and enjoined to report to him rather than Parliament in terms of Section 12. While the PFMA stipulates that an autonomous public entity ought to report to Parliament, and that's in terms of Section 51, 1F of the PFMA. This critically undermines the fund's accountability to Parliament and is potentially an unconstitutional delegation of power on the part of Parliament to the Minister of Health. And therefore, we recommend that the bill must state clearly that the fund reports directly to Parliament for the exercise of proper oversight. What's more, the minister has discretion in making key appointments as the bill is currently drafted that has to do with the governance and structure of the fund, including the board, its chairman, and the CEO. This is in sections 13, 14, and 19 of the bill, respectively. And thus, the minister has extensive influence on the functioning of the fund. This is added to by the fact that the minister also oversees the appointment and functioning of the advisory committees, which are involved in critical operations of the fund, that's in terms of Section 25 of the bill. The effect of all this is to place a great measure of power and influence in the hands of the minister in an entity that is meant to be autonomous and independent. And therefore, we recommend that the provisions regarding the governance of the fund be revised in order to allow it to function as a truly autonomous public entity and to insulate it against undue interference into its functions. We recommend this be done in two ways. Firstly, an independent panel of duly qualified individuals must be constituted to conduct interviews for the appointment of the board and to make recommendations to the minister. The minister must provide reasons if any recommendations are not accepted. Secondly, there must be provisions to ensure that there is no interference by the minister or any members of the executive in the working of the NHI Funds Board, which includes the appointments of the CEO and the decisions made by the board. The next issue I want to specifically speak on has to do with the relationship between present medical schemes and the National Health Insurance projects, which we speak to in page 7 of our written submissions and which I speak to briefly on the presentation on slide 11. Concerns have been raised about how the NHI will affect private healthcare through existing medical schemes. And this is something, as I mentioned earlier, ought to be addressed in the bill as far as possible, with, of course, the knowledge that the bill being an overarching structure can't really go into the details and the minutiae of how this will actually work. The bill currently says that users will be entitled to purchase complementary health services not covered by the fund through medical schemes provided for in Section 9G as well as Section 33. The brief treatment of this issue leaves important issues unanswered and is, I think, to a large extent why many people have questions about this. We therefore recommend that the role of medical schemes must be more clearly defined, specifically how they will be phased out and what happens to persons who, for whatever reasons, do not register as a user of the National Health Insurance and thus cannot use a public health care facility. If the medical scheme is not permitted to cover the services that the public facilities do, will the patient be left without treatment? Will they have to pay a private provider out of pocket? Those sort of things just need to be fleshed out, we think, in a bit more detail to address the concerns of many South Africans who currently have access to private healthcare specifically. Lastly, I want to speak briefly on the issue of financing, which we discussed on pages 7 to 8 of our written submissions. You can also see mention of it in slides 12 to 13. The bill currently says that it's considered the financial implications for the state via an actuarial costing model, which has not been made public. It's therefore impossible to evaluate or comment on this, and we think that the government should take the public into its confidence and in the interest of transparency, disclose the financing and implementation plans in order to enable a proper evaluation of this critical aspect of the bill. Further, the bill says that it will be financed by money appropriated by Parliament and other sources in Section 46(3). The bill does not, however, deal with the financing of transitional arrangements. We therefore recommend that the bill should provide for how the initial and carry-through costs, such as administration and infrastructure, will be financed during the phases prior to the establishment of the NHI fund. This should also address the cost of making arrangements for the accreditation of public health facilities and providers. Thank you all very much for your time, and I look forward to receiving your questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Shosi, for the presentation. You can say whether you have any other members of your organization on the platform with you, and if you do...
Unfortunately, I do not. It's just me.
Hi, I do. I am here.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I didn't see you. Yes,
sorry. I'm here. I said anything. Thank you.
Can you introduce yourself, Ms. Badia?
Yes, good morning, and thank you for having us. I'm the acting chairperson of the Active Citizens Movement, and Bongani has been, Bongi Nkosi has been very involved in helping us draw up our submission. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, you've heard the presentation. I see very few have indicated that you want to ask any questions. We have Honourable Munyai, then followed by Honourable Gela and Honourable Hubbard. Any other members who want to ask any questions, you're very welcome to just shout it on this platform now. Honourable Tiwela, your hand is raised. Is that about a question? Honourable Tiwela?
Chairperson, yes, it's about a question.
Yes, thank you very much. Honourable members, any other members who want to ask any questions to the Active Citizens Movement? Otherwise, we will go with those. First will be Honourable Munyai, second Honourable Gela, thirdly Honourable Hubbard, fourthly Honourable Tiwela. In that order, thank you very much.
Thank you, Honourable Chair and Honourable esteemed members and the presenters. I want to ask the following question, Honourable Chair. One is that your concern, I'm referring to organisation that presented here, about the lack of alignment between the National Health Act, it is noted. Are you aware that the National Health Act is mentioned 34 times in the NHI bill? Are you aware of that? Maybe for your reference, section 54 subsection 8 subsection 4H also state that in order to enable the introduction of the National Health Insurance, the following legislative reforms or amendment will be initiated: a Medicine and Related Substance Act, Health Protection Act, Medical Schemes Act, Mental Health Care Act, National Health Act, and other relevant acts. This is a matter of fact. It is also important that I must ask the other question, which I am going to do now. Honourable Chair, I must ask the presenter, is there any indication in the bill that the PFMA is excluded or the role of the Parliament is limited? It's important to ask that question. How do you therefore interpret Chapter 5 of the Constitution of the powers of the Minister? Is ACM proposing that Section 5 of the Constitution be amended? It is very imperative to get this clarity. The last question, you have asked that you want to know how the medical aid should be protected? Are you aware that the current system, current status quo, have two-tier systems? So do you want the status quo to be retained? One for the rich, primarily handled by medical aid schemes, and those that are administered at aid schemes, and the others for the people that are excluded. Because precisely the NHI is intended to help all the people, regardless of their socioeconomic status, whether they are rich or poor, and so on. What is your view? It will be glad to get your answer to this question. Thank you.
Honorable Gayla.
Thank you very much, Chair. Let me also welcome the presentation from Active Citizens Movement. My first question, your recommendation that the fund chairperson and its CEO must report annually to Parliament is well received, which is something that is going to happen. We are noting that. And the, have you noted Section 51, subsection 1, on annual reports submitted to Parliament? This section states that as the accounting authority of the fund, the board must submit to the minister and Parliament a report on the activities of the fund. Do you need a further clarity in this regard? That will be my first question, Chairperson. The other question that I want to ask, ACM appears to be of the view that the bill has excluded a certain categories of children from benefiting from the South African health system. Has the presenter familiarized himself with Chapter 2, Section 4 of the Bill, and Section 28 of the Bill of the Constitution? May I get some clarity as to where this is done in the Bill? The other question, Chairperson, what is the ACM's proposed alternative to the use of the term illegally foreigners? What would they find to be a term or phrase that is non-discriminatory? Would alignment with the term used in the Refugees Act of 1998 be acceptable? My last question, Chairperson. Is the ACM aware that currently the Minister of Health is empowered to appoint the boards and CEOs of a number of entities and statutory regulatory bodies that fall under the National Department of Health? Why does it seem that the ACM is very opposed to the same approach applying to the NHI fund and its structure? Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Chair, and also thanks for the presentation from Active Citizens Movement. Only one question. The ACM has highlighted areas in the bill which they refer to as constituting bad governance. My question to you is, to whom should the NHI fund be accountable to if it is considered as good governance? If it does not report to the Minister of Health as the international, as the national executive or cabinet member signed, such responsibility in Section 91, 92, and 101 of the Constitution. I thank you.
Honorable Siwela.
Thank you, Chairperson. And I also have one or two questions to ask. Just by way of comment, the presenter spoke about good governance versus bad governance, and seems to suggest that if the minister is involved in these things, it will probably represent bad governance, if my recollection serves me well, because he went on to say that good governance requires independence and accountability. Independence from whom? Is he suggesting that if the minister is involved, there will be no accountability in that regard? The second question would be, you're concerned about the role of the medical schemes in is acknowledged. Some stakeholders informed us that over the years, the costs of private health care have been increasing, and that medical aid schemes members are not well protected. There were also complaints about serious governance challenges in this industry. This observation was also made by the Health Market Inquiry. Based on this, I have the following questions. One, in your view, does this situation not threaten achievement of universal health coverage? Two, what is your view about people insuring against the same health care cost twice? By this, I mean duplicate cover or double dipping. Does this not lead to inequitable healthcare financing? Will this not perpetuate the current inequities, thereby threaten achievement of universal healthcare coverage? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, honorable members. Any other member before I ask my question? There are some who have not indicated yet. And honorable Siwela, if you can lower your hand so that I am aware when you have a new hand. I have three questions I want to raise with the Active Citizens Movement. And the one speaks about the NHI fund, cost of administration. Now we note you're raising this and it is well received. Section 2 of the bill states that the NHI fund will be a single purchaser and single payer of healthcare services in order to ensure equitable and fair distribution and use of healthcare. The white paper further outlines that due to economies of scale, along with efficiency gains as a result of reductions in non-healthcare costs because of strategic monopsony purchasing arrangement services, the NHI admin costs will not be above 5%. I would like your comment on that, please. Then in slide 11, you mainly focus on medical schemes and appear less interested in the consumer health related issues of which the provisions of the bill seeks to address. My question is, what is perceived as the undesirable impact of the provisions of the bill on medical schemes? And further, you're proposing that government should develop legislation that is specifically addressing the interests of medical schemes. How do you think, as ACM, does this proposition that there should be exclusive legislation for medical schemes? How can this be achieve reduction of fragmentation in the financing of healthcare services? And very lastly to you, your concluding slide seems to insinuate that there doesn't seem to have been enough consultation on the NHI policy and the bill. We are aware, and we're asking whether you are aware of the numerous opportunities that government has provided for public comments on various versions of the NHI policy as well as the bill. Did you participate in any of these processes? Thank you very much. Those are the questions from me. I do not think there are any other questions from any of the honorable members. You can please answer those questions, and Mr. Shorzy, you can also allow the other members of your board to of your organization to respond. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson and members, for your questions. There were quite a few of them. I'll do my best to recall and address each of them, but if I miss anything, please feel free to point it out to me and I can circle back to it. The first question related to whether we are aware to the numerous references to the National Health Act in the bill, and we are in fact aware of them. We just specifically are concerned about certain aspects which may lead to overlap and duplication of functions. However, this is something that can be addressed in the form of amendments to the National Health Act. And so if this is something that the committee feels will be adequately addressed, then we think that is sufficient. We simply wanted to bring attention to it because it potentially will be an area of concern and or conflict. The next is the question about the roles of the minister from a constitutional perspective and whether we contemplate the amendment of the minister's powers. I just want to emphasize that, and this touches on several of the other questions that were answered, we do not suggest that the minister should be stripped of any of their existing powers in terms of the constitution or the law. We simply suggest that the various functions that are currently provided to the minister in the bill require a greater level of transparency. They require a greater level of accountability, and they require a lesser level of fiat given to a single individual to make key decision-making choices, simply because we think that a functionally independent NHI fund would be in the best interest of all South Africans. And so we don't contemplate that the powers of ministers should be altered or changed, but rather that the exercise of these powers should be modified in certain ways in order to secure the independence of the NHI and its various structures. The other issue that was raised had to do with whether we are in favor of maintaining the status quo of the two levels of healthcare provision with public and private and the various disparities that come with that. I think we touched on this in the few opening slides, but I do want to address this once again. We are 100% in favor of a universal healthcare coverage system. We simply recognize that because South Africa is coming from a system where private healthcare coverage did exist, we think that this transition from private healthcare to a universal healthcare coverage needs to be addressed in a more explicit and nuanced way, simply because many South Africans are very concerned about it. And so we think that this is important, not just from the perspective of providing clarity and security to a specific group of people, but rather to ensure greater public buy-in with the national health insurance and its structure. So that is the entirety of the extent of our recommendations in that regard. Simply addressing these issues for the sole purposes of reassuring people and getting them invested rather than protecting the interests of the few and the rich and the privileged. The next issue has to do, I believe, with Section 51, although I was not entirely sure about the exact nature of the issue regarding that section, so perhaps the individual who raised that question can clarify for me. But as far as I'm aware, it had to do with whether we were aware that there were currently provisions for reporting on the part of the NHI fund to both the minister and parliament. And yes, we are aware of it. We simply think that the current wording is such that it creates the impression that the fund in various of its functions, including the reporting, has to go through the minister. And we think that this needs to be addressed in more detail, such that it is clear that the fund is directly accountable to parliament in relation to certain functions like financial reporting. Regarding the exclusion of children, this is something that we go into in specific detail in our written submissions, but if I can just briefly try and address it. Essentially, within the current structure of Section 5 of the bill specifically. Children over the age of 12 are capable of being registered within the National Health Insurance structure as users. However, children under the age of 12 can only be registered with the assistance of an adult if they are what is termed as a child-headed household. So what that does then is create a situation where children who are under 12 and not in child-headed households cannot, without the consent of their parents, become a user in terms of the National Health Insurance Act. This creates a circumstance where if a parent unreasonably refuses to register their child as a user and that their child is under 12, that they cannot become a user as the wording of the bill currently is. And so I hope I've given clarity on that. Regarding the use of alternative terminology, the person who raised this question at the same time answered it as well. We are, again, in support of adopting the language used in the Refugee Act, and so I don't think I need to go into more detail there. And as to the issue of why we're opposed to the fact that the minister in various other institutions has the ability to appoint key individuals such as boards and CEOs within the Department of Health, we recognize that this is the status quo. However, as we allude to in our written submissions, in the various positive examples of state-owned entities functioning well and functioning effectively, there is a level of independence that is required in order to allow those institutions to function effectively. We think that given the importance of national health insurance, we need to ensure that the fund and its board and its CEO are able to be in an environment that allows them to focus on promoting the best interests of South Africans and are not put in a position where they are subservient to a specific member of the executive. So again, we're not suggesting that the minister should be eliminated, but rather that various mechanisms should be put in place in order to allow the national health insurance structure to function independently and effectively. There was also a question raised about if the board and the fund is not to be accountable to the minister, then who should it be accountable to? I think I've addressed that with my previous answers. And so I'm going to move on to the next question about what is our view on the possibility of a duplication of coverage? Namely, a situation where some individuals are able to continue to pay for private funding for their health insurance, as well as take advantage of the structures created by National Health Insurance. Again, this is something that we think could actually be adequately addressed either in the National Health Insurance Act itself or in various regulations. However, we do not think that a duplication of services is necessarily in the best interest of South Africans, and therefore we think that that's something that should be avoided insofar as is possible, except insofar as individuals will of course be seeking to acquire insurance for areas that are not covered by national health insurance, and that's something that we do not think should be taken away from people, but insofar as basic healthcare services, we think everyone should fall under the same umbrella. Regarding the question on purchasing arrangements, we are aware that this has been addressed somewhat. We simply call for in our written submission specific clarity, and I can direct the members to our written submission for more detail on that. Regarding, again, slide 11 and how we think addressing the issues with private healthcare coverage as it currently exists aligns with the goal of reducing the fragmentation in our society. I again just want to reiterate that we are not defenders of the private healthcare system or individuals who are currently benefiting from that system. We simply recognize that because of the magnitude of concern that people have that are currently making use of public healthcare coverage, the future of public healthcare coverage needs to be addressed so that South Africans can understand what's going to happen to them and how the future of the universal health coverage will be charted in the South African context. Regarding our comments on public comments in the last slide, if insofar as we created the impression that we are not aware that there has been extensive public consultation, I apologize for creating that impression. We were simply emphasizing its importance, and indeed we are very impressed by the lengths to which this committee and government as a whole has gone to involve members of the public, ourselves included, who were part of the public consultations here in KwaZulu-Natal. So that was simply just an emphasis on our part and not intended to suggest that there had been necessarily failings on the part of the committee. I hope I've addressed anyone's questions, and if there are any follow-up questions, I'm happy to address.
Thank you, Mr. Shoji. Any other members from your organization want to answer any questions?
Thank you. I think Dr. Shozi has covered us adequately. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Shozi. Members, we've now had the presentation. I want to thank Dr. Shozi and his team for this presentation. And we are also thankful for the answers which you have provided us to the questions which were raised by the honorable members. Any last comments from yourself?
My only comment is to express on behalf of the ACM as a whole that we support the work of this committee, and we're happy to have provided constructive recommendations for how this work can be improved.
Thank you very much. Honorable members, we have the last group on the platform at the moment. If you need a 5-minute break, a comfort break, you can indicate. I'm very happy to just continue. Can we continue? Yes, we will. So we have the very last presentation coming up. Just to say to Dr. Shozi, you're welcome to stay, or you can also leave the platform, whatever suits you, but you're welcome to listen to the last presentation of the day. The presentation will be by the Lawyers for Human Rights, and we have Ms. Sengiwe Machacha already on the platform. I also noticed that she's been made a co-host, if I am correct, for her to be ordered to be able to do a presentation. You are very welcome. Please introduce your team, Ms. Machacha.
Good morning, Chairperson and to members of the Portfolio Committee, and good morning to all colleagues who are on this platform. I believe I'm appearing on my own today on behalf of Lawyers for Human Rights. As the Chairperson has introduced me, my name is Sengiwe Machacha. I'm an attorney and I'm working within the Refugee and Migrant Rights Program at Lawyers for Human Rights in the National Office based in Pretoria. And I would just like a little bit of indulgence to figure out how to share the presentation.
You're very welcome. Remember, while you're doing that, you have 45 minutes to do your presentation, and we'll take another 30 minutes for questions and answers. And if you...
Thank you.
Oh, yes, there you are. Thank you. Please continue.
Right. Thank you, Chairperson. We'll just go right into our submission. This presentation is basically a summary or a conversion of our written submissions to a PowerPoint presentation. And we have made those submissions in November of 2019. And I will just proceed with the presentation. Seem to be having a bit of trouble. Right. So Lawyers for Human Rights is...
There is someone who is not muted in the background, Honorable Hubbard. Please mute your system. Honorable Hubbard, can you please mute your system? Please continue, Ms. Wachacha.
Thank you, Chairperson. LHR is an independent human rights organization with a 40-year track record of human rights activism and public interest litigation in South Africa. And our work spans over six thematic programs, including land and housing, environmental rights, penal reform, gender equality, strategic litigation, and the Refugee and Migrant Rights Program. We have four refugee law clinics in Johannesburg, Pretoria, Durban, and in Messina. Our submission will speak to the section dealing with population coverage and eligibility in the NHI bill. We argue for asylum seekers and migrants to be eligible for access to the NHI. In terms of statistics, the mid-year statistics for 2021, which I have slightly updated from the written submissions, they estimate that the population of South Africa is around 60.4 million. Please bear with me as I try to adjust my screen. There are around 180,000 asylum seekers registered with the DHA, and the number of applications for asylum has steadily declined over the years. In terms of just looking at the legal framework of refugee rights, I've included some international and regional pieces of legislation and instruments, but this does not cover all of the legal instruments that affect refugees and asylum seekers. The African Charter on the Rights and the Welfare of the Child is relevant. The UN Convention on the Rights of the Child is also relevant. Obviously, the South African Constitution of 1996, the Immigration Act, and finally, the Refugees Amendment Act, which has been amended in 2020. The inclusion of asylum seekers and migrants, redressing of the past discriminatory laws and policies. Now, we say that since South Africa is a constitutional democracy, where everyone who resides within its borders are entitled to the guarantee and protection of their human rights, the law is a powerful instrument to achieve this objective. So it follows then that asylum seekers and migrants must be included as beneficiaries in terms of Section 4.1 of the bill, or Clause 4.1. And this argument is supported by the preamble to the NHI bill, the Constitution of 1996, and the White Paper on International Migration 2017, that being a Department of Home Affairs document. The preamble to the bill states that it recognizes the socioeconomic injustices, the imbalances and inequities of the past, the need to heal the divisions of the past and to establish a society based on democratic values, social justice, and fundamental human rights, and the need to improve the quality of life of all citizens and to free the potential of each person. Now, looking at the Constitution, the preamble clearly says, part of the preamble, which I've quoted here and paraphrased, that South Africa belongs to all who live in it, united in our diversity. So by excluding foreign nationals, be they migrants or asylum seekers, the NHI bill fails to meet the constitutional ethos and vision articulated in the preamble. Looking at the White Paper on International Migration of 2017, under colonialism and apartheid, immigration through citizenship was limited to Europeans, and so-called natives were confined to the Bantustans and could only move around as migrant laborers. The 1999 White Paper recognized these past injustices and sought to retrace them by further opening travel within the SADC region. However, the policies retained some features of the past migrant labor system in that, for example, the government issued company visas for low-wage migrant labor, and that refers to farm workers and people working in mines, etc. The 2017 White Paper indicates that it seeks to address a policy gap that existed in the 1999 White Paper in that migration patterns within the SADC region were not properly addressed. We argue that a continued exclusion of predominantly Black African migrants and asylum seekers amounts to a failure to break from the injustice of the past discriminatory legal system. Now, moving on to the context of communicable diseases, including HIV, AIDS, and TB. The bill allows asylum seekers and migrants, including their children, access to emergency medical services and services for notifiable conditions of public health concern. We submit that a policy that calls for the exclusion of migrants for basic health care is detrimental to public health. We'll refer to public health concerns, including HIV, AIDS, and TB, and finally, towards the end, COVID-19. Research provides compelling arguments demonstrating the barriers that migrants face in accessing healthcare are counterproductive for host countries. Only allowing access to healthcare for treatment of communicable diseases in the interest of public health to a population that is considered quote-unquote illegal will leave migrants vulnerable and afraid to come forward for treatment of curable communicable diseases like TB, for example. The 2009 report by Doctors Without Borders states that today, Zimbabweans are still often charged exorbitant fees to access public facilities, despite policies to the contrary, turned away from hospitals when they need admission, discharged prematurely, or subjected to harsh treatment by health staff in the public services. And I've included a link to the article. In terms of TB and HIV/AIDS, continuing in that thread, the International Labour Organization produced a report titled Labour Migration and HIV/AIDS in Southern Africa. The article makes a compelling argument for redress and not punishment by exclusion of migrants to access healthcare. The ILO also points out the epidemiology of HIV/AIDS is closely linked to the process of migration. Migrants and mobile populations in general have played a significant role in the initial spread of HIV in the Southern African region. However, the fact that population movement distributes HIV has become less relevant in the current stage of the epidemic in Southern Africa, with extremely high HIV prevalence levels in the population in general. The ILO then states that migrants are no longer agents that help to spread HIV, but have become individuals at high risk. Several studies have also shown that migrants are more vulnerable to HIV infection than their non-migrant counterparts. South Africa has a high incidence of TB infections. The World Health Organization statistics give an estimate of around 454,000 cases of active TB in 2015. If migrants and asylum seekers are harassed for documentation, they will not come forward for healthcare services. To contextualize this a little bit, what we mean is that when accessing healthcare, one often had to identify themselves first. And migrants who are either not properly documented or have expired documents, even when they're ill, they will be afraid to come forward because of discrimination that might follow. So even those who are entitled to services for notifiable conditions of public health concern will not come forward for healthcare services irrespective of the dangers to public health due to the fear of arrest, detention, and deportation. We argue that there's no rationale for exclusion. There's no scientific-based research that supports the exclusion of migrants and asylum seekers from access to the NHI and basic health services in general as an argument to save costs. Our past discriminatory policies seem to have persisted in current legislation, providing no rational basis. The unfair discrimination of asylum seekers and migrants is no different. I'll pause here just to mention that we have noted in terms of Department of Home Affairs policies, for example, there's been a steady regression of protection of the rights of migrants, of refugees specifically, and asylum seekers. The 2009 article written by Kuvade et al. Titled The Health and Health System of South Africa, Historical Roots of Current Public Health Challenges, states that the roots of a dysfunctional health system in South Africa can be found in policies from colonial subjugation, apartheid dispossession, to the post-apartheid period. We include a link as we did in our written submission. Another category of refugees and migrants that is often overlooked is that of climate refugees, environmental migrants, and environmentally displaced persons. The global climate crisis has, among other issues, created climate refugees and environmental migrants. Climate change leads to three types of migration-related effects on health. Firstly, primary or direct effects, such as injuries and health, and death, resulting from extreme weather events. Secondly, secondary or indirect effects from the increased geographical range of and populations exposed to new diseases. And third, tertiary or delayed effects from disrupted health services for individuals in need. Host countries of both categories of migrants must include these groups in their health services. There needs to be inclusion and addition of resources to support migrant health as opposed to exclusion. Unfortunately, we've noted there is a global law and policy gap in this regard, that climate refugees and environmental migrants are not properly legally recognized. Now, looking at the changing environment and the movement of people, as well as the implications for South Africa. Globally, the dehumanization of refugees has increased, and long-term displacement appears to be the norm. In the lead-up to the elections in May 2019, in South Africa, was rhetoric of scapegoating migrants. This is in the broader context of xenophobic utterances and attacks. Public figures have made unsubstantiated claims that foreign nationals are burdening the public health system. With official StatsSA data estimating the population of foreign people in South Africa at around 3.6 million persons, it is rational to allege that the group is placing a serious strain on public health in a country with around 58 million residents. This is 2018 data. As I mentioned in the beginning, 2021 data places the population at around 60.4 million. And now we get to the real issues or the problems that asylum seekers and refugees are experiencing in documenting themselves. It is the dysfunctional asylum system. The Refugees Act states that the overall time frame for the status determination procedure should not be longer than 6 months, that is 180 days. But the reality is that over 185,000 persons with asylum seeker status have waited over 5 to 10 years for their applications to be finalized. This administrative injustice leads to discrimination specifically towards those whose documents are expired and they are assumed to be illegal foreigners. These people are denied access to healthcare services according to the NHI bill due to no fault on their part. So it's going to look a little bit of detail what I mean, what this administrative injustice really means is that not only do the asylum seekers who are the main applicants for refugee status get affected, but their children are also affected as well. And the unfortunate assumption that a person whose document has expired automatically becomes an illegal foreigner is often wrong. Asylum seekers are always at pains to explain that the reason, most of the time, the reasons why they are holding expired documents is not their fault. They haven't neglected renewing their documents. They are just, unfortunately, victims of a very slow and sometimes not well-functioning system. And obviously, this affects the children as well. In terms of international law, we've noted from 2017, the Department of Home Affairs added to the dysfunctional refugee status determination process by denying newly arrived asylum seekers without passports the right to apply for asylum. The result is that asylum seekers are left undocumented and unrecorded in South Africa. To give a bit more detail, what happens is that when a person who is seeking refuge in South Africa arrives at the border, they are supposed, even if they don't have any documents at all, they are supposed to be given the opportunity to apply for asylum. However, the practice with the DHA started in that people were compelled to present a passport so that they can be allowed into the asylum system, which we say is wrong because it violates the 1951 UN Refugee Convention. referring back to migration and health then, we have mentioned a 2018 commission report from the UCL, Lancet Commission on Migration and Health, which reported that in 2018, around 1 billion people were on the move globally. The commission also stated the following important points regarding migrant persons' access to health, that in 2015, world leaders committed themselves to universal health care as one of their strategic development goals. Many countries exclude migrants from access to health care, especially undocumented migrants, and this goes against the SDG commitment. A study in several European countries found that extending access to healthcare to migrants resulted in savings of direct and indirect medical costs. Looking at COVID-19, we have, the Lawyers for Human Rights has been actively participating in the Migration and Coronavirus in Southern Africa Coordination Group. And in June of this year, the group published an occasional paper, which I quote as follows: based on extensive desk-based review and supplemented by key informant interviews, the paper shows that the vast majority of international migrants, refugees, asylum seekers, and IDPs, which are internally displaced persons, are being excluded from state-based vaccine rollout programs either via formal policy directives or through various forms of de facto exclusion, such as barriers to access to healthcare at the local and national level. These forms of exclusion are likely to have far-reaching public health implications across the continent, affecting both citizens and migrants alike. In August of 2020 of this year, again, the group published, they didn't publish a report, but they reported in one of our engagements, reporting on the persistent challenges for migrants in accessing healthcare. And as Lawyers for Human Rights, within the Refugee and Migrant Rights Program, we can confirm that the following is indeed happening to asylum seekers and refugees and migrants. It seems there's no foreseeable plan for undocumented migrants. The response from the vaccine sites and the EVDs is not clear. For example, some people with blocked IDs can register. And the reason why I mention people with blocked IDs is because in our Refugee and Migrants Program, we have a specific project known as the Statelessness Project, where we assist both foreign nationals and South African citizens who have never had identity documents or birth certificates. We have, you know, been following up with some of them to find out if they are able to register on the EVDs, if they're able to access vaccination sites, even though we know for a fact that they have blocked IDs or duplicate ID numbers. And we found that the response is different, with some getting access to vaccine sites and others not really being able to register online as well. So it's not clear what the practice is in terms of undocumented people in general. Secondly, the document validity challenge remains with the DHA online renewals. What has happened is that the Department of Home Affairs, in response to the extended lockdown, have indefinitely closed the refugee reception offices, which means that refugees and asylum seekers cannot go to those offices in person to renew their documents. However, the minister then allowed an online renewal system, and refugees and asylum seekers and their dependents, their family members, can use the system to renew their documents. However, that system has posed some challenges in terms of access. People who don't have access to email and access to internet cafes, etc., are being exploited, you know, being asked to pay high fees just to send an email to the Department of Home Affairs. And in some instances, the system takes a while to respond to an application for renewal, and there are other technical challenges as well. So what has happened is that asylum seekers and refugees have been, undocumented for an extended period, especially in the context of the lockdown. This leads to challenges in accessing healthcare. As I've mentioned, the challenge with documentation. This is not a new challenge in terms of accessing healthcare. It's not particularly coming up just because of COVID-19 and lockdown. There has always been that discrimination, but it's just become worse now that many more asylum seekers and refugees don't have the opportunity to renew their documents. Institutionalized discrimination, healthcare facilities don't have a consistent response to asylum seekers and refugees. In most instances, when an asylum seeker or refugee is approaching a hospital for medical care, a public hospital or a clinic, they are told, no, you must have a green ID book, or you must have an ID card or permanent residence, or else you have to pay the highest fees. There are inconsistent practices. So in some hospitals in Gauteng, we know that there was a new policy that basically how it works is that if you are a foreign national, you have to be placed in a specific category or a patient category, and you pay according to those fees. Now, the challenge is that documented migrants, most of they pay on the highest scale. However, asylum seekers and refugees whose documents have expired due to no fault on their part during the lockdown are automatically categorized as on the highest scale. And we consistently have to intervene and engage with the hospitals to explain to them that the reasons documents are expired is not, it does not firstly make the person an illegal foreigner in terms of the Immigration Act, and secondly, it is no fault on their part and that they must be categorized properly. In terms of tertiary health care services, we know that they are limited in that there's no chemotherapy or dialysis treatment for refugees and asylum seekers. And we have we are constantly engaging with these types of matters through our work in our law clinics. So the organization has engaged with many people with asylum, refugee, and various migration statuses who experience these challenges. Now, to move to the recommendations and conclude, we recommend the following. Firstly, an analysis of the evidence of migration, what drives migration and how it affects South Africa. Secondly, urgently obtaining disaggregated data. Thirdly, that the Department of Health work closely with Statistics SA and that STEP SA is prepared to collaborate. Policy formulation and budgeting needs to be done against this verifiable data, and also the Ministries of Health and Home Affairs need to work closely. For example, we propose the creation of a health passport where regionally recognized patient health records to ease cross-border access to health services. We recommend that it must be ensured that the response to COVID-19 does not present barriers to non-citizens, for example, documentation for testing and or vaccine registration, to ensure continuity of care is not affected, including the response to TB and HIV, and also regarding the response to COVID-19. So there must be continuity of care for other illnesses as well. To ensure that migrant and mobile communities, including children on the move, LGBTQI+ persons, migrant sex workers, and migrant workers in labor-intensive industries such as mining and agriculture, are proactively included in care strategies. And that is the end of my presentation. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Ms. Machacha, for this presentation. I must say, I note you speaking mostly only to one topic, and we thought maybe as lawyers you would have engaged us a bit more on the bill. But regardless of that, we thank you for your presentation. And as you know, members will be raising questions, and we would appreciate it if you'd be able to answer those questions for us. I'm going to raise the names of the members in order. It would be Honorable Ismail, Honorable Munyai, Honorable Havard, Honorable Gela, in that order. Any other members who want to raise any questions? You may shout on this platform in case I have missed you or you have not raised your hand. No other members. Thank you. In that order, thank you, honorable members. I'm going to repeat it. It's honorables Ismail, Bunyai, Harvard, and Gaela, and then I will also ask one or two questions. Thank you very much.
Good day, and thank you for the presentation. I just have two questions. My first question, why, in your view, has government excluded refugees and asylum seekers in the bill? My second question, in slide 18, there is mention that a study in Europe showed that extending access to healthcare migrants resulted in savings of direct and indirect medical costs. Can you give us an example of this? How did it result in savings, just for us to better understand? Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. As I said earlier, my network is very bad, so to an extent that I will not be able to use the camera. But again, I think I concur with you. Most of the presentation was broad, not specific to the bill on concrete issues that they would want us to look into the bill. But nonetheless, let me pose the following question. Can the lawyers for human rights propose how government can mobilize additional financial resources to cover asylum seekers and migrant population, whether they are documented or not undocumented? Are there any other good international or regional benchmarks that you wish to put forward as a concrete recommendation for our government to consider? What do you think of the role of the multilateral structures or multilateral fora, such as the SADC, AU, United Nations, and the International Organization for Migration, to support government if this category of inhabitants are not really accommodated under the National Health Insurance? But the other key issues, I mean, I've not heard you speaking about the economic refugees, I mean to say. Most of the refugees here, let's say for instance, coming from the Republic of Zimbabwe that are here, they're not necessarily political refugees or something else. They come here, they work. I must say that some of them could be perhaps refugees of hunger, but they come and work. But during December, 6.5 million in the bed bridge, I'm sure you have that data, will be passing through going to their home. After that, they see their family, they come back. So how do you, what status do you consider for such type of refugees? Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair and the presenter. Only one question from my side. How does lawyers for human rights propose the bill addresses issues of sparsity of health resources and health professionals in cases where an influx of users is allowed entry into health facilities beyond what the system can cope with? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Is it me next?
Yes, continue, Honorable Girl.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me also join my honorables by welcoming the presentation. I have only a few questions that I want to ask. Can the LFHR provide the actual numbers of people in the Republic who are asylum seekers, refugees, and those who are asylum seekers? How will health plan for this category of people residing in the Republic if their numbers are not known? That will be my first question. My second question, you mentioned that refugees do not have equal access to healthcare in South Africa. Do you feel that in the bill, Section 5 refers to a user registration and Section 6, a right of users, does not cover the concern that you are raising? Thank you very much.
Any other member wants to ask any question before I raise my question or two? You may shout on this platform.
Honorable Chair, I just have a follow-up.
Thank you. You may, Honorable Munyai.
You know, across our neighboring countries, all we see female persons that come or publish that come to South African hospitals and flood them just to give birth. From there, and also they come here from Swaziland and others just to get a pension from South African government. What is the concrete recommendations of the human rights condition, at least to to support the efforts of South African government under this severe pressure?
Thank you, Honorable Munyai. I have two questions I want to just raise with you. The first one is for the benefit of the committee. Can the lawyers for human rights give an example of any system aimed at moving towards universal health coverage that is sustainable if the cover they are proposing is in place? The borders of South Africa are currently very porous, and a porous health system that is open to all and sundry without any form of rationing and restrictions for refugees and asylum seekers can prove very detrimental to South African citizens. This would create serious sustainability issues for the fund and impact service delivery for all citizens. Can the presenter propose how the NHI fund can maintain its sustainability? And in your expectation and your proposal on the health passport, is it that South Africa will see to the needs of all citizens in the continent when they have a health passport as put forward by you? Can you also point us to an example of a health system either developed or developing country that provides all the refugees and asylum seekers with free healthcare services at all levels of care without any form of restriction in terms of registration and eligibility for covered services? Those are the questions, Ms. Machasha, from the members of the Portfolio Committee. The very last one, I just want to ask you, does your organization support a proposition that the NHI can be used to identify and document identify documentation supported by the Department of Home Affairs and our security cluster so that their presence in the country becomes known and documented? In other words, do you support a proposition that the NHI can be used to actually identify those people and then have them documented? Thank you very much. Those are all our questions. Please feel free to answer those questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think I've got all of the questions, and I'll do my little best to respond as best as I can. And if there are still gaps, we will be happy to send written, substantiated written answers to the questions. So I'll try to go in order. And because I think, like the other honourable member, who's starting to have issues with the network, but I'll try to remain on video as much as possible.
Thank you very much. We will also look forward to your written responses if you cannot answer those questions.
With regards to why the exclusion of refugees, in my opinion, in our opinion, why are refugees excluded? I think, as I commented in part of the presentation, you know, there were moments where I was adding a bit more context to the submission. We have noted that, especially in the Home Affairs policies, the exclusion or the regression of refugee rights or the exclusion of refugees is because our understanding, and we do agree, people are not supposed to be refugees indefinitely. It's supposed to be, especially asylum seekers, they should only hold the temporary asylum permit for a maximum of 6 months, and then the status determination process is supposed to be concluded, so that that person either has the option or the legal pathway to apply for permanent residency and then in future apply for citizenship. So we do understand maybe that might be the reasoning that holding refugee status indefinitely, it's not a good position. One must it's either that the conditions in the country of origin must change and things are more stable politically or whatever the reason was, and the person is able to return, or they become permanently resident within the host country, which would be South Africa in this instance. So that would be my response to the first question. And with regards to the study in Europe, I will have to go back into our written submission and provide more detail in that regard. I cannot substantiate the answer currently, and I do apologize for that. The second set of questions of how can government mobilize additional resources in terms of including, being able to include migrants and refugees. In our view, the context of the legal rights of asylum seekers and refugees is meant to put them on the same level as South African citizens and permanent residents. In terms of basic socioeconomic rights, Section 27, in terms of the right to access to healthcare. We are very much aware of the fact that this access is subject to the availability of resources from the state. And that is something that we, you know, we're very much aware of, in that even citizens struggle to get full access of healthcare services. So to the extent that refugees and migrants and asylum seekers are legally included in terms of the constitution, we submit that inclusion must continue even in national health insurance, and that there must not be an irrational exclusion simply because a person holds a different document. For example, asylum seekers do have the right to work and study in South Africa. The children of asylum seekers can access schools. And quite recently, with regards to social services, an organization known as Gallabrini Center in Cape Town went to the High Court to, compel the Minister of Social Development to include asylum seekers within the Special Relief of Distress, Social Relief of Distress grant during the lockdown. So in terms of socioeconomic rights, asylum seekers should be included to the extent that the state can mobilize those resources. So it's a balance of ensuring socioeconomic rights, but also within the available resources of the state, and there shouldn't be any irrational exclusion. And then in terms of the question on are there any benchmarks on a regional level, again, I would have to make a written follow-up response to that within looking, for example, at the SADC region, the AU, etc., in terms of how these multilateral forums can support the government, we'd have to revert with that. But we are very much aware that the UNHCR, which is the High Commission on Refugees, does support universal healthcare that includes migrants, and there are guidelines as well on how that can, how universal healthcare can be done by states, and we can provide those guidelines that the UNHCR has made available online as well. With regards to a question on economic refugees, I do agree. I mean, I've tried to include all the categories of refugees that we are aware of. Definitely the Zimbabwean people mostly are economic refugees, but legally what happens is that they have limited options because economic refugees don't exist in the law. They either apply for asylum, and in their application for asylum or for regular refugee status, they would state to the Department of Home Affairs that we are escaping an economic crisis, and those applications are rejected, unfortunately, because they simply don't qualify. But the special dispensation, the Minister of Home Affairs did issue a special dispensation permit for Zimbabwean nationals to recognize the economic crisis that happened around 2008, and in 2011, a special dispensation permit was issued free of charge to Zimbabwean nationals, and that permit allowed them to work in South Africa, and it also allowed them their children or their dependents to get a study permit in that sense. So there are those steps that the South African government has made to accommodate that specific group of economic refugees. Now, in terms of the question on the foreign nationals who come to South Africa to use services such as, I didn't quite understand the question on pensions, but I didn't quite understand what that pension refers to. But with regards to people coming to South Africa for health services, I think it's just testament to the fact that the South African health system is more beneficial, or it would be better than where the migrants are coming from. And I think that when we refer to the health passport, which I'm going to go into more detail on again, it will be beneficial in our view to the South African government if the government is aware, especially the Department of Health and Department of Home Affairs working together, if they are aware of these dynamics and the reasons why people would migrate temporarily just to access health services and to interrogate why is that happening, and how states can work together, especially on a regional level in the SADC, in terms of supporting one another. Not to say that South Africa must now support every country that seeks refuge or migrates to South Africa, but there needs to be more discussion of an understanding why the nationals from other countries are opting to come to South Africa, and how that can be regulated in terms of accessing health services. As I mentioned, the access in public facilities puts migrants in different categories, and there is a category of migrants who have to pay the highest fee, and that is a policy that is there. We understand it, but the only issue is that when it comes to applying that policy, there is an inconsistency or a misunderstanding of the type of document that one must present in order to be categorized as a private patient in a public health facility. So more discussion, I guess, information sharing between states, especially within the SADC region, will probably have to happen there. In terms of the scarcity of health resources that government cannot cope with, I do agree. The resources are very limited in most instances. But where, as I mentioned earlier, where the state does have the resources, for example, to support with social grants, we know refugees are are actually permitted, or they do qualify for SASSA grants, for example, and it obviously makes sense that they are included in clause three in terms of the users as well. But when it comes to asylum seekers, they are unfortunately just victims of a system that is very, very slow to determine their statuses. And we ask that this committee be mindful of the fact that it is of no, not in their control that they are being subjected to holding temporary documents for an extended period. If there is a way for the different government departments to work together to accommodate asylum seekers, especially looking at the impact that exclusion can have on children, we would support that. The question on the actual numbers of people who are asylum seekers, those are the statistics. I mentioned earlier that there are around 180,000 asylum seekers. That's the rough figure, but we are not sure at the moment with the online renewal system how many asylum seekers and how many people still hold refugee status. So it is something that we would have to engage with the Department of Foreign Affairs to get current statistics in that regard. The other challenge with trying to get concrete statistics on refugees and asylum seekers is that asylum status should lead to refugee status, but within the status determination process, those people can potentially be finally rejected and then become illegal foreigners within the country. So that means they may eventually have to leave, and that will affect the actual stats as well. So it really depends on the status determination system of the Department of Home Affairs, and we will have to go back and verify those stats at the relevant time. So I do agree it can be very difficult for governments to accept when the numbers are not really known, and that's why we keep on emphasizing in our recommendations that disaggregated data is very important and that statistics SA can possibly assist. Just to mention that in the last few months, I think in the last month or so, the Department of Social Development of that SA did hold a migration conference where they were, trying to harmonize what the real stats are with regards to migrants and their migration status, and how that affects how the state is able to provide services as well. And we can provide reference to that conference and its outcomes as well in our further written responses. I think the next question was about the example of a system that is giving an example of a system that is sustainable while including migrants, and how the fund can increase sustainability. I have to be frank here, there isn't a one example that we can give, but in terms of our written responses, we can substantiate the example of including migrants. But as I mentioned earlier in the presentation, generally, the in 2015, what came out of the SDGs is that the member states don't really support or include migrants in their healthcare systems in a generous way. So, there isn't really compliance, or there isn't a perfect example of how that is happening on a global level. To just summarize, it has not really been done as far as we are aware. With the example of the health passport, what we mean by that is we are proposing a record, not necessarily a state-issued document. It's just a record from the health user themselves or the patient to say, I am receiving health care for this particular condition back in my home country, and I'm here in South Africa to continue that treatment. And if it is possible for the South African government to continue that treatment, especially for matters of public health concern, we submit that it should be done. So that person would get sort of an informal document. It's more like a hospital card or a clinic card. It doesn't necessarily have to cost the state anything to keep those records, except to say that it will, the South African government will recognize that document and take it seriously as a health record, as opposed to starting over again and trying to register the person. And then also with regards to the rules in terms of accessing health, all of the same rules would apply in terms of the category of the patient and the affordability and whatever the South African law says with regards to that person. The health passport is really aimed at showing a record of the treatment that this person is already receiving and trying to continue that treatment and allowing different member states, for example, within the SADC to say, yes, we recognize that document. I see that a hand is raised. I'm not sure if I should pause.
No, you can finish that follow-up question. Are you done?
No, just a last response is to say, do we support identifying documentation being recognized? Yes, we do. We do actually advocate for the recognition of documents, different types of migrant documents, for example, asylum seeker permits and refugee permits, so that service providers such as healthcare providers can recognize those documents and know what treatment or what services a person who holds a certain type of document is entitled to. So in terms of just educating those who may not be aware of the different types of documents, we do advocate for that so that there is a uniform practice across the board. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think there's a follow-up question by Honorable Munyai.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair, and also the presenter. I would have preferred to address the presenter with the last name. However, I just did the first name. It doesn't matter. Will their organization be very happy if we evoke the security class that would deal with these issues of immigrants, so that at least, you know, issues of national security and issues of the, you know, are also addressed, because as they know, it is very important that the South Africa as a country, its national interest and national security is protected. Will they be happy if we make sure that the security cluster address and verify, deal with these issues of immigrants? Process it, yeah.
Thank you, Honorable Munyai. Honorable Ms. Machasha.
Yes, we have been making submissions on amendments to Refugees Act, you know, commenting on Immigration Act amendments, etc. So we are engaging with the Department of Home Affairs specifically on a regular basis. What we do advocate for is for the rights of migrants and refugees who are entitled to those socioeconomic rights and the proper administration of status determination of refugees and asylum seekers. I think even looking at the wording and I think it was the organization just before we presented that was speaking about terminology as well. As soon as one is described as an illegal foreigner, the idea is that, well, then the next step is arrest and detention and deportation. But there needs to be an awareness that sometimes people become illegal foreigners through no fault on their part. So in as far as the security cluster, the Department of Home Affairs can assist us in protecting those who are not violating the law willfully, then we will definitely I'd be happy to engage on those platforms and continue as we have been doing. Thank you.
Thank you very much to Lawyers for Human Rights for coming today to present to us. We note your presentation. We also note your answers to the questions which were raised with you. Any last comment with you from you? Thank you.
Sorry, I lost my screen. Just want to express our thanks to the committee in allowing us this opportunity to also make oral presentations over and above the written submission. And yeah, we look forward to further engagement and we'll definitely be happy if there is a progressive inclusion of those who need universal health coverage as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, we are done with the oral presentations on the NHI public hearings for the day. We are now going to deal with the minutes. We have four sets of minutes which we need to approve. Those are the minutes of the 18th of August, 21st, 24th, 31st of August, and then also of the 1st of September. We will go directly to those minutes. Ms. Majalamba, if you can flag the first set of minutes, please. Thank you very much. Honourable members, I would hope that you would have read the minutes. We will go through them very fast if you had. So if we can you make certain that your name is captured if you were present in the meeting? You can go to the next page. Thank you. This was the meeting of the acting chairperson nomination and vote, and let's carry on. It deals with these two pages on that. And also there was a consideration of the previous minutes which we had adopted, so the 4th of June, 17th, June, 21st of July, and let me just see that the 4th of August, yes. Thank you. Can I get anyone to move for adoption of these minutes? Any corrections?
Chairperson.
Yes, Honorable Gela.
I move for the adoption of the minutes.
Thank you very much. Any seconder for the adoption of the minutes?
I second the chair.
Thank you, Honorable Albert. Can we go to the next set of minutes, please? Honorable members, this was the briefing by the Acting Minister of Health on an update of vaccine procurement, the progress on the vaccination rollout program on the 24th of August. Please note whether you've been captured as being present on that particular day. Can we go to the next page? This meeting was chaired by our acting chairperson, Honorable Bunyai, who made some opening remarks and congratulated the minister and deputy minister on their appointments. And then the minister made some remarks on the next page. Next one, please. Then there was a briefing by the department, and it was done by Dr. Chris. And then there was some discussions. Next page. You can just shout, honorable members, if there's anything that you note that you might have a concern with. You can stop there and then from there. Any members? Nothing? Thank you very much. Can I ask for a mover for the adoption of these minutes?
Chairperson, I move for the adoption of the minutes.
Thank you, Honorable Gela. Any seconder to that mover for the adoption of the minutes?
Chair, I move the adoption. Thank you.
Thank you. Move for the second. You're seconding the adoption. Thank you, Honorable Dr. Abbott. And next set of minutes. These are the minutes of the 31st of August, 2021, the election of the chairperson, and then we had NHI public hearings. Please note whether you are captured as being present, if you were indeed present. Next page. The first part just deals with the election of the chairperson, and then we had a presentation from SAWU, and unfortunately the presentation from the Black Business Council who presented today, they couldn't present on that day. It's a very short, and we actually lost the connection with Mr. Klopper, and so he was not able to give us any answers. There was a request that we would write to him, the secretary would write to him, and they should provide written responses to the questions which are raised by the committee members. Any mover for adoption of these minutes, please?
I do, Honorable Chair. I avoided to do on the previous two or three because I was facilitating or sharing that meeting. Thanks.
Well, yes. You're right. Thank you very much.
Other issue with Mr. Glover, if he doesn't answer to the written response, we may have to invite him to come here, because if we don't close the matter, technically, let's say we are taken to court, that matter can be attended. Can be attended or raised as inconclusive matter of his presentation. I just want us to be cautious of such a situation. Because failure for him to respond, we may bring him for 20 minutes just to respond to those questions. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Honorable Munyai. We note what you've just been saying. Honorable members, Honorable Secretary, if you can make certain that either what Honorable Munyai had said is captured on our next minutes, and we actually do the follow-up with Mr. Klopper. Thank you very much. Next set of minutes.
Sorry, Chair.
Yes, Ms. Majalam.
We don't have a seconder. Mr. Munyai moved for
that. Thank you very much. Yes, Mr. Munyai's response has just taken me off track a bit. Any seconder to the adoption of these minutes, please?
I'm seconding, but we are still waiting for the response. A written response.
Yes. Ms. Majalamba, maybe I could just ask you, had we written the letter to Mr. Klopper? I think the members are actually asking that question.
Yes, Chair, we have posted the recording of the meeting also for him to respond to all the questions that were raised by the members. Thank you, Chair.
And we're waiting that response.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Majalamba. Next set of minutes. Honorable members, this was the meeting of the 1st of September. We had a briefing by SAPRA, and then we had considered and adopted the committee's oversight report in KZN and Gauteng provinces. And we also had considered and adopted some minutes. Please note if your name is captured. Next page, please. We know that we had a presentation by the CEO of SAPRA, and we also had the chairperson of the board of SAPRA who gave some input initially. And these are the discussions which have taken place, honorable members. You will see on that page that has quite a lot to do with vaccine hesitancy and the concerns which are raised, which were raised by the honorable members. Honorable Munyai?
On the previous page, the spelling of Professor Rees has been wrongly spelled.
Yes.
There's no E there at the end.
Yes, we'll ask for it to be corrected. So we must, when we adopt, we'll just say with that, with the amendment, please. Next page. Anything there, honorable members, on that page? You will note that we had touched on many points. Next one. Next page. Honourable members, I must say this makes for very interesting reading. So any of us who want to just recapture our thoughts, this is a very good document in terms of the presentation by SAHPRA and the comments made by the members. And this will really assist us to gather our thoughts around what is, of course, a continued discussion as far as COVID is concerned. So I'm going to ask for members to move for the adoption of these minutes as amended and mentioned by Honorable Munyai on the name of Professor Rees.
My name is Chidizim Nyai. Honorable Munyai, I do so with amendment.
Thank you very much, Honorable Munyai. Anyone to second? Any member?
Chaperson, I'm seconding the approval of the minutes.
As a true reflection of what we stated. Thank you very much. Honourable members, I think that's the last minutes which we have to adopt today. Am I correct, Ms. Majalamba?
Yes, that's correct.
Thank you. Honourable members, we do not have any other items for today. We note that Parliament is rising today, as I mentioned earlier in the morning. We are going to resume on the 2nd of November. We already have a tentative program, and we must be reminded that that program is informed by the program of Parliament, as instructed by the Programming Committee. I wish you all very well during the constituency period. Please stay safe. Take care of yourselves, and we will be seeing one again on this platform as the Portfolio Committee of Health. Also, to all of our staff members who support us so very well, we appreciate all of the hard work which they do in the background. And yes, see you then on the 2nd of November. The meeting is then adjourned.
Thank you, Chaperson.
Thank you, Chair.